This week's episode of the FitCast is brought to you by XFMuscle.com, home of the best tasting protein powder out there. Also, don't forget to check out their bulk ordering options as well. This week's episode features music by The Postal Service. You can check them out at subpop.com. Welcome to this week's episode of the FitCast. This is episode number 200. I'm Kevin Official. Larrabee, and I can't believe we made it this
unofficially,
far.
It's like 203.
It's official. And along with me is Dr. Jonathan Fass, because he sent me an email last week saying I have to call him doctor, so I did it. And also Lee Peel of LeePeel.com. How you doing, Lee? What's up?
I'm good. I really think that you should have introed that differently, though. It should have been a lot more monotone. Like, hi, welcome to the 200th episode.
Like NPR.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk about that later. Holy crap, we have a big show for you guys this week. Like 3 hours long podcast. Oh, or is it an hour and a half? We don't know yet. It's either one or the other. Find out after you download this. Anyways, show this week. Lou Schuler, Dan John, Alan Aragon. It's all there. It's a lot.
This one people will be talking about, I have a feeling.
Yeah. One thing. First off, Lou Schuler doesn't swear, so you can listen to his interview with the kids in the car. Dan John, one or two, but, you know, it's well-natured. It's PG-13. Alan Aragon, rated R, both he and myself.
Like a drunken sailor stubbing his toe.
Yeah, and we might have – I listened to the interview that we did, or at least parts of it again, to kind of hear how it sounded. And I'm going to preface it by saying, he and I were just kind of, you know, talking, and – We both talked about some subjects that can tend to be a little bit
controversial.
So that's all I'm gonna.
Feelings can be hurt,
but feelings shouldn't be hurt because again, it's only a discussion. With everything that was said, we have respect for all populations involved. So let's just get that out there ahead of time. So you guys, episode 200. What do you think?
I'm looking
pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. I think it's quite an accomplishment. Honestly, mm-hmm. I think it's a big time accomplishment. I mean, if we existed on ratings, then maybe we would have been canceled like years ago. But we don't.
We would have been the Firefly of our time, or the Oh my God! If people will please somehow allow me
keep
to
the FitCast going, there would have been some type of thing on Facebook to keep us going.
Absolutely. There kind of was.
It's just like, getting better.
There was a time when we almost ended the podcast. I don't know if you guys remember that when I made the foray at Game Trailers.
Oh, that's right.
I do remember that. I don't think I realized that you were going to end the FitCast, though.
No. Well, there was discussions. Because I honestly did not know if I was going to be, you know, going into, you know, that. You know, that side of things. But what I wanted to quickly reference is we would have been the journeyman of our time. Best show to be canceled far too soon. I recommend watching it on Hulu. Great, great. If you like Quantum Leap, this will blow you away.
Oh.
So no off topic this week because we have a big-ass show. And I don't know. Do you guys have anything you want to say for episode 200? I think I'm going to just... I said it a little bit in 199.5, but you know, obviously, thank you so much for everyone that has spent the time to download and listen to our podcast over these last 4.5 years. You know, we started this thing in April of 2006, believe it or not, and you know, it's been a huge honor, and I think some of the greatest emails that I've ever got from you guys out there is just you know. I'll talk about myself for a second, how I've grown as a, you know, as a trainer and a coach, call myself a coach, John, as a, you know, I feel like I am like that guy that they would put on a TV show. If you are new to the series, I'm that guy watching at home who is learning about all the stuff that's going on around them as the audience is. And like the rookie on the squad, you know, who is, you know, has the same perspective of not knowing everything. But, you know, I feel like I've grown quite a bit these last 4 years, and there's no way I would have done it without this podcast, being able to interview, even like talking to John and being able to talk to Lee, you know, the couple times that we've had Tony Gentilcore on in the last couple of years, and, you know, Keith Scott and Jen Heath. I mean, we've had a lot, and Cass. I mean, we've had a lot of hosts on the round going around the you know, as we kind of transition, like SNL, lots of television references. But and also John Williams, who this show never would have started without him, I don't think. And he was the first guy that I emailed and said, hey, you know, I'm thinking about this. Would you do it with me? And it's like, absolutely. Hell yeah. And now 4 years later, John got married, has a kid. You know, it's amazing how much things have changed over the last 4 years. John, you took a deep breath like you were going to say something.
No, I think I was more gasping, like, oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Like, good on him.
And I have a dog. Officially, now you can – the dog is here, so he's kicking around in the background. But I don't know. Lee, do you have anything?
I think that it's pretty impressive. Me and – because, John, did we start at the exact same time doing this together?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's funny, and I don't know if anybody knows this, we didn't plan that.
No, right? we just had a show with the three of us.
It just happened.
Yeah.
And I find that to be, I don't know, it's very, it's kind of strange.
Yeah, I think that you had been on like the episode before me or something as a guest, mm-hmm. and then I was a guest, and then we were just, Kevin's just like, oh, you want to do another show? Okay, awesome. Yeah.
I think I sent an email to you too saying, this is what I'm thinking, will you be willing to do it?
Yeah. And it just kind of happened. And I think that in itself, it's been 100 episodes now.
Yeah.
Since then.
Yeah.
Almost. And that's pretty, it's pretty amazing. And
that's crazy.
I know that I've changed already within the course of all those episodes. That there's a lot of things that about my business and my life and a lot of things.
You can dance again.
I'm getting there. I am. I'm getting there.
Awesome.
And I became friends. With, because I mean, me and Kevin, we weren't friends, you know.
No, I didn't like you at all.
I didn't like you at all either.
you can actually no. This is actually a true story.
That's true.
This is true.
So tell we didn't like each other.
No, on
really?
No, on no, the we're... on the like the fitness forums. I guess supposedly I wrote. I correct me if I'm Kevin wrong, but I wrote a post. I'm like, who's this Lee Peel? Why are you guys? I totally disagree with her on something on a forum before I even invited her on the podcast, and I guess Lee was kind of pissed.
Awesome.
We're not fans of each other. And I remember the first time I got asked to come on the FitCast, I remember I was friends with someone within the industry, and they were like, you're gonna go on there? Don't you and Kevin like hate each other? And I was like, I don't hate Kevin, but I mean, whatever. We'll see how it goes. Next thing I know, it went really, really well. We got along amazingly, and I'm a co-host, and I think it's
my God, you guys are like besties.
Well, no. Yeah. I mean, I have no, I love Kevin.
No, I can honestly say I truly do. I cannot be happier with how this show has evolved over these last, you know, year, 2 years or so. And I can honestly say you two guys are great friends. So I'm trying not to tear up here, but you know, I love you guys both, and you know. I would not have nearly as much fun doing this, and look forward to doing it as much if you guys weren't doing it with me. Oh, that sounded bad. But you know what I mean.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. And that's the only way we
can have our loving moment.
Yeah,
that's right.
That's what she said.
I have to ruin everything. My best friend, who happens to be female, likes to point out that my particular brand of love is that there's a little seed of hate planted in every kiss. So, yeah. So, so that warm moment there, I had to break that up.
Yeah. You just had to ruin it. But
no. Yeah. Love you too, Kev.
I love you guys. But yeah, I think that's pretty awesome. And I think that how it's evolved has been pretty fantastic.
Yeah. I have to say that too. I mean, I think that's kind of cool because that's the feedback that I always hear, that it's always like, oh my God, it's like listening to a bunch of friends, and because it kind of is.
I mean, that's the good and the bad feedback that we get. You know, the people that tend to not like the podcast as well, it's like, oh, it sounds like a bunch of people just talking to each other.
It is. That's what we're doing.
It's like, sorry, you didn't pay for the podcast. You know, I like the crowd that we have, and I love our audience because, you know, obviously it's we're able to get information across and interview guests a certain way and make it a lot more, you know, if you want, we talked about this a little bit before recording today, but, you know, if you want the NPR of podcasts, we're definitely, I don't think we're that. Other people, I think Mike Robertson does a great job of this In the Trenches podcast. The way he sets them up, they're much more formal, and it's 101, where, you know, I think we have much more of a, you know, it's a community aspect to it. And we are, honestly, there's many times where we record the podcast and we talk for over an hour after we're done recording the podcast, just about stuff.
At least, yeah.
I mean, there was one day where we spent literally 2 hours, and I took two bathroom breaks.
Yes, you did.
We talked about politics. We talked about, you know, stuff going on the internet, on TV, and it was ridiculous.
Yeah, it was great. I have some off the air conversation for you too, Kevbo. Oh.
For after today?
Sure.
Nice. Okay.
Well, I could tell you now, but we're not doing an off topic. We're doing an ode to us.
Yeah, right.
It's true. And we are awesome.
Okay.
So let's keep this going.
John, you're so awesome. Tell me how awesome you are.
I'm pretty awesome, dude. You know what? I just had some tea that I actually got from India.
Oh.
I'm drinking Spike that I actually got from Colorado.
From the intertubes?
Came right from the mountains of Colorado.
Drinking water that came from the hills of Greensboro, North Carolina.
Came from the well in Lee's backyard.
Well, it was also, we were at, when we were in Mumbai, they had like this, you know, they'll give you like, you know, oh, have some coffee, whatever. So they had this box of stuff and they're like, oh, with our compliments. And it was all this tea and coffee and crap. I'm like, don't mind if I do. And just shoved that crap right in my back. I like just dumped it out. I'm like, woohoo, free crap.
Oh, man.
This is Indian tea. It's the good stuff. And I just dumped it all in. So. And then the travel manager's like, you know, we have to pay for that. I'm like, nah, it said it was free.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, and I have to do something real quick. Just for some of the fans, because I updated on Facebook that I was recording the 200th episode. And to Carl Von Danger Morris, and which is the best name ever, and Alan Fleming, I just wanted to shout out to you. And then I'm also, happy birthday, Cass. Today is
Cass's birthday, Cass.
31.
So happy 31st. Happy birthday.
Yeah, it was Tony's last week, or 2 weeks ago.
Yes, it was.
It's been a lot of birthdays.
Wow. He who shall not be named.
Mm. You know what? We have lots of hardcore listeners. And I mean, I would say, like, you know, I'd like to name a bunch of them, and there would just not be time. You know, and you guys know who you are. You're the guys that, you know, we talk to on Twitter, on Facebook a lot, and send in emails, and have Danger as your middle name, or. Are going through school, our hardcore audience out in Australia, put another shrimp on the Barbie for us, show us what a real knife is, that kind of stuff. You know, you guys are all great, and, you know, no matter what kind of fan you are, whether you tune in every other week or you're just tuning in for the first time, you know, like I said, you know, it's tough that we don't get to meet a lot of you, and we hope to. It's something that we talked about a lot in the last couple months is, you know, hopefully we can do something where we can have some kind of planned meetup, or maybe like a meetup slash mini seminar kind of thing, and meet some more of you guys, because the event that we had in Chicago was super flattering, and it was one of the best times that I've had in my life. Just going out to dinner, it was going out to dinner with friends and, you know, talking to people, and my dog's jumping on top of me, and he's smelling, oh, he's clicking the keyboard, which could do something bad. But yeah, no, I can't thank you guys all enough. And I just hope that you continue to stick with us as we continue to go into, you know, 250 and 300, and maybe one day we'll get to 1,000, but we only have a couple more months until 2012 world ends.
That's sad.
Gotta get saved by that guy from all those teen movies.
I'm waiting for John Cusack.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, stop jumping on top of me right now. I'm trying to podcast.
And that's what she didn't say.
What she said. That's true.
What are you jumping on me for? Oh, I wish you guys had a video little thing right now. But all right, well, I think that you guys have anything else before we go into the interviews?
Nah, do it, man. Don't let these people wait any longer for these freaking epic interviews. Are you crazy?
Okay.
All right. I want to hear them.
All right. Well, seriously, let's start playing some interviews. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next week for 201. All right, we're here for the third interview. We're probably going to run this one first, though. So we're here with Lou Schuler of LouSchuler.com. Jonathan Fass is with me. Lee is with me. And we tend to have Lou on every year or so because he was one of the first interviews that we ever did on episode 7. And he's just a great guy to talk to. And he's got an awesome new book coming out that I have the copy right here next to me. I got a nice pre-release copy of The New Rules of Lifting for Abs that he's authored along with Alan Cosgrove. Lou, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Kevin.
Well, first, let's talk a little bit about this book, because this is the third book in the series, the New Rules of Lifting series, that you've obviously did the first book, and then New Rules of Lifting for Women, along with Cassandra Forsyth as well. Let's actually just start off talking about, like, what kind of brought along the third book? You know, what's the whole history behind it?
The third book starts with a tale of woe. It actually starts with a chainsaw accident in my, well, chainsaw-related accident in my backyard. A tree had fallen over in a storm, neighbor's yard, went out, chopped it up with a chainsaw. My chainsaw dies, and I've still got this big old hunk of log that I have to carry from my neighbor's yard all the way to my wood pile, which is, you know, pretty, I don't know exactly how far, pretty long distance. So, you know, being, I at this time, I was like a few weeks from turning 50. I was almost as strong as I'd ever been in my life. I was still not necessarily setting PRs on the basic lifts, but I was working with getting close to my PRs and everything when I went down to low reps. So here I am, strong as I've ever been, almost 50 years old, pick up this thing, throw it over my shoulder, and my shoulder's never been the same since. That was the start of it. Next thing, I hurt my knee in the gym doing a stupid exercise that nobody should ever do. And a short time after that, I end up with a hernia, and this is all on the right side of my body. And you think, well, one thing, well, no big deal, happens to everybody. Two things, yeah, well, that, you know, life's difficult. Three things, it starts to look like a pattern. So these injuries weren't just singular events. They somehow fed into each other, so that by the end of that summer of 2007, I could barely walk. I mean, I would have like a meeting in New York, you know, no matter, you've got to walk somewhere. And so I'm wearing knee braces underneath my jeans. I'm limping around everywhere I go. I can barely walk downstairs. I'm kind of doing like a hopping on my left leg and just kind of hanging my right leg out in space to get, and this is like, you know, having a meeting with the editor of my book. So I'm looking bad here, right? You're writing fitness books and you can't walk. I mean, that, you know, in, in, in my profession, that's kind of a liability. So as I began to work through my injuries, as I began to do rehab type exercises, the way that I trained was completely different from the types of workouts that you see in the first two New Rules books, as well as Book of Muscle and Home Workout Bible, Testosterone Advantage, all the things that I'm associated with, going back to my men's fitness days. Basically, you warm up for a little bit, you go in the gym, you lift. So now I'm working out in a completely different way. I'm spending the first 10 to 15 minutes of every workout doing mobility exercises, rehab exercises for my specific injuries, and then I would spend like the next 10 minutes just doing core exercises. Now, I can't pretend that I had a great plan, but I just knew, okay, I've got to do something. I got this hernia. I've got to shore up this area. I've got to develop some stability so that this injury doesn't get any worse and so I don't get any more new injuries. So all of a sudden now, I'm spending like 20, 25 minutes before I even get over to the weight room. And of course, with all these injuries, I'm really limited in what I can do in the weight room. And to my utter amazement, not only did I manage to rehab the injuries, but I found that I was leaner than I'd been in years. I was faster than I'd been. I played on a senior baseball team. This was the first time I'd played in, you know, since I was like 12. And I think by the time I played on the baseball team, I was 52. So it's like a 40-year gap between the last time I played baseball and now. And I really sucked, I'll confess. But I was fast. I sucked at this really high speed, which had never. I'd always been a really slow suck kind of guy, and here I was like a quick suck, you know, I was like stealing bases and stuff. And so I'm thinking, this is like, I've got this whole new body. What is it? So, some point, I'm talking to Alan Cosgrove, and he tells me that he's completely changed his approach to the way he trains his clients. And the reason he's doing this is he's finding the clients, he has to do more now than to warm them up and take them into the weight room and accomplish things through, you know, with a barbell, dumbbells, kettlebells, the way we have in, you know, the way we've shown in our books. So what he's doing with his clients is first 10 minutes of every workout, they're working on mobility. The next 10 minutes they're working on core. Then they're 20 minutes in the weight room. And then the last 10 minutes they're working on metabolic, you know, doing some intervals and some, you know, combinations like push-ups, body weight squats, that sort of thing. And he's finding that because his clients are coming to him in worse shape than they ever have before, I mean, when they walk in his door for the first time, he's had to change his approach to incorporate all these other elements to get them, you know, they have terrible core stability, so he has to work on that. Terrible conditioning, he has to work on that. Horrible mobility, he has to work on that. So somewhere in there, he has to squeeze in 20 minutes with the weights because they're also coming to him usually pretty, you know, pretty weak and deconditioned. So he's got to find a way to do all this in 60 minutes, whereas 60 minutes used to be almost all strength training. Now it's all these other elements of fitness. So we found that without talking to each other in advance, that we had both sort of come to the same sort of training methodology, which was very different from what we'd had in our first two books. We'd gotten there for different reasons, but we'd gotten to the same place. And so, you know, when you at that point, okay, well, if this is what we're doing, and we've got two books out there showing readers a different way of doing things, not that there's anything wrong with that, but this is what we're doing now, we should really write about this. And so that's how the book came about.
It's interesting that you bring up, you know, how Alan sets up his workouts, because one of the things that he focused on most at the Perform Better Circuit is, you know, the core stability aspect. And like you said, his clients are coming to him in worse and worse shape now, and especially in the area of the core. With, you know, we all know the stories of people with low back pain and things like that. So, you know, one of the interesting things that he did is say, you know what, if it's important, we got to put it early in the workout. You know, the mobility, it's important. Let's put it at the beginning of the workout. The core stuff, it's important. Why are we putting it at the end of the workout? We have to put it at the beginning of the workout. And that's something, you know, as I've gone through the new book, you know, I've definitely seen in the training program. So I just think that's really cool. We talked a little bit before we started recording the interview, and you've mentioned it on your blog at lewschuler.com, but you did have to go through hernia surgery. I mean, that's something that my boss at Mike Boyles is doing right now. He just had surgery for hernia as well, and it's to be honest, it's hell. Can you talk a little bit about that experience and then kind of coming back from that?
Sure, yeah. I prepared a lot of groid-related material, so I'm happy that that we can talk about these pelvic issues.
Awesome.
I don't know. The hernia just sort of showed up one morning. I just noticed that there was a bulge there that had never been there before. It wasn't anything specific. It's probably genetic because two of my siblings have had, you know, have had hernias. So what bothered me about it was that nobody, especially after years of training, and in my case, close to 40 years by then, because I'd started working out when I was 13, you never want to think that I was weak in some area and that's why this happened. But once it had happened, I said, okay, well, now I've got to shore this up to keep it from getting any worse. Eventually, after I put it off as long as I could, and then I said, okay, this is, you know, it's definitely time to get this fixed. I picked a time when, you know, I could, it was like the kid's first day at school, and, you know, my wife dropped me off at the surgery place, and, you know, after she put the kids on the bus, and so, you know, ran in there, they knocked me out, they cut, you know. So I had like 4 weeks to recover. And this is what I found the most interesting part of this whole ordeal was that I was walking as soon as I could walk, walking around the block a few times, you know, when I could do a little bit of, you know, some light exercise, I was doing that. And finally, after like 4 weeks, started in with a light strength training, and then about 6 weeks got back, you know, started building up my strength again. But what I found the first time I picked up weights again, 4 weeks after the surgery, was all of a sudden I had these left-right strength imbalances that I'd never had before. I'm right-handed, and all of a sudden it seemed like I can use like twice as much weight with my right side as I could with my left. My balance was off, my coordination was off, and I thought that happened in 4 weeks after more than 50 years of, I should say more than 40 years of exercise by that point in my life, that in just 4 weeks. Now imagine somebody who never trains. Imagine what kind of imbalances they're going to have. And I'm sure Jonathan deals with this all the time, and Kevin, I'm sure you deal with your clients too. But here, here's somebody, I've been doing this for 40 years. I didn't feel like I had any strength imbalances beyond the fact that I'm right-handed, and so, you know, the right side's naturally just going to get a little bit more work. But I'd never had this kind of imbalance before, and now I had that. So it was like, here was a problem that was completely unanticipated. The other problem that I still haven't figured out what to do with was I had this incredible mobility, you know, just like in my regular, you know, like you do the walking, like a Frankenstein walk as part of your mobility drills where you're kicking one leg up at a time, kind of stiff-legged, you know, like a North Korean soldier on parade, you know, where you're kicking up the leg as you're, you know, doing your mobility drills. Well, see, I used, you know, both legs, I could kick, you know, way up above my eye level. So I get this hernia sewn up, and all of a sudden I can barely bring the legs up to the chest. And weeks and weeks later, I'm still, you know, that mobility isn't returning. And I'm thinking, so all this fantastic mobility that I had, it was basically because I had a hole in my abdomen, you know, they sewed up the abdomen. And all of a sudden now I'm not, you know, I now I've got like really mediocre mobility. And I think, man, I feel cheated. But
when you put it that way.
If that's like the worst thing I have to deal with, that's fine. But I just thought that was interesting.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, as far as the structure of the book goes, Lou, I've read New Rules of Lifting, both for women, and the original. Are the workouts going to be structured anything like that structure was set up? Are you going to have, you know, cardio follow it? Are you going to have just the mobility lead in with the strength? Like, what's the kind of general structure that's going to be in place for the abs book? Is it going to be specifically, we're going to work the abs, or how is it going to be broken up?
Well, yeah, I mean, the reason the word abs appears in the title is because we had, I had worked on the book Core Performance with Mark Verstegen and Pete Williams, terrific book, best book I ever edited. I worked on that when I was at Rodale, and now Mark and Pete's Core Performance books are actually their most recent one was edited by my editor at Avery. So, and plus my agent represents the Mark Verstegen and the Core Performance series. So there was no way we could put the word core in the title, even though what we're talking about here is core training. So that's why we use the word abs in the title. And I know this, it sounds like a little inside baseball, I think all of us were uncomfortable using the word abs, other than the fact that we knew that it was a commercial, you know, it'll get people's attention and all that. That's all great. But it's sort of, when you put the word abs in the title, you're sort of implying that, you know, here's a bunch of spinal flexion exercises, here's a bunch of crunches and sit-ups and cable crunches and cable sit-ups and hanging leg raises and all these spinal flexion exercises that are going to produce hypertrophy in the rectus abdominis muscle, and you'll have these big bulging, you know, camera-ready abs. And what worries me is it's not that you won't have great abs if you're doing this program and you're lean and you're fit and all that kind of stuff, because I certainly found that my muscles got quite a bit more developed than they had been before. In fact, my surgeon actually complimented me. He said that he said that my the amount of muscle he had to cut through was about twice as thick as what he normally has to cut through when he does a hernia surgery. And I'm thinking, wow, boy, I'm what a stud I am. And then I saw the people sitting in his waiting room, and you know, they're all like 70. And so I'm going, well, all right, so not that big a compliment. So to get back to Lee's question, so what we're starting with a far more detailed mobility program than we've ever had before. It takes about 10 minutes to get through it. 10 minutes of core training. There's three different levels of core training. The first few weeks you're going to be doing static stability exercises, and of course we all know the plank and the side plank. But it gets a lot more difficult from there. Basically, if you can do the basic moves, couple sets of 90 seconds on a plank, couple sets of 45 seconds on each side on a side plank, then you move into the more difficult stuff. And by the time you get to the end of that section, if you're able to do all those exercises, you know, you're hanging from a TRX with, you know, one foot on a, you know, your hands are on a TRX, your one foot's on a Swiss ball, the other one's up in the air. And it's like, I can't even do that stuff. So, you know, there's like an almost infinite number of variations you get before you even get to the next part of the program, which is where we get into the integrated stability, and that's where you're maintaining spinal stability while moving one or more limbs. And then finally, in the final phase, you're maintaining spinal stability when there's a dynamic environment where you're like doing a squat while holding one weight overhead, or you're doing some exercises with a deliberately unbalanced load, which is, you know, like say you're doing farmer's walks, holding two dumbbells overhead, but one of them's like 20 pounds heavier than the other. And the great thing about that exercise is people get the hell out of your way. They think if you're so crazy, you don't even realize you got two different size weights in your hands. They don't want to be anywhere near you. So that, you know, if you're in a crowded gym, that's a great exercise to do. It creates all the social distance, gets people out of your way. So those are the three levels of the core training program. Then we have a strength program, which also is at three levels with a lot of exercises, where you're working with fairly heavy weights, but you're still you put yourself in positions where you're doing exercises that require you to stabilize your spine. You're rarely going to be just flat on a bench lifting a couple of weights. You might be hanging off the bench lifting a couple of weights. So there's that, and then most of the workouts finish off with some metabolic training, you know, ladders and intervals and that. So, you know, most of the workouts are going to be about 50 to 60 minutes. You don't necessarily have to do all that in one session. You can break it up and, you know, say do the intervals and metabolic work on a different day. You can separate it by a couple hours if you want. You know, it's basically we give you one idea of how to do it, and, you know, you go from there.
Thought it was interesting that you mentioned, Lou, the core performance books from Mark, because it was, you know, those books were like 6-7 years ago that they were released, and I think that was also at a time in the industry where it was all this, the functional stuff and everyone's stability balls and BOSU and everything that you do has to be core, and then there was kind of like a backlash to that almost, and a lot of people completely disregarded core. So I get my core when I deadlift, I get my core when I squat, and people seem to even shy away from any direct training of the core whatsoever. Now with sure. This book, it seems like
and by the way, we debunk that. We find the studies and we completely debunk what you just said, that you can get all the core work you need from
right.
deadlifts and squats.
Right, and that's exactly, that's the problem, because you kind of can't. And, you know, now it seems like with this book, now we're moving back. But, of course, it's a twist, because it's not necessarily all the BOSU unbalanced stuff. Or if it is unbalanced, it's a different type of imbalance. So talk a little bit more about that, about how, you know, what's the difference here between what you're saying in this book versus, you know, maybe 10 years ago what we were talking about with the Bosu revolution and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, sure. You know, in Mark's book, and like I can't speak highly enough of not just the book, but Mark, working with Pete Williams, his co-author, just terrific guys. It was a terrific book, great project. I learned so much from that book, but I don't think anybody would write that book that way today, simply because we know so much more about this. When Mark originally laid out his core performance program, it was, I think he had like six stages to the workout, and one of them was physio ball. That was a stage. And I don't think anybody now would give a workout a name based on the equipment you use, because, I mean, the equipment is, let's face it, it's just a tool. You know, I know there's people out there who market themselves as kettlebell guys, but, you know, really, a kettlebell's a tool, a dumbbell's a tool, a barbell's a tool, Swiss ball's a tool. You can do our workouts without any one of those things. You know, if you don't have kettlebells, fine. Don't have a Swiss ball, fine. All kinds of other variations. You don't need these specific things. They help in certain ways, particularly when you're talking about those static stability exercises. Like I said, once you get to the point where you can hold a plank for like 90 seconds, there's really no reason for you to keep working on the basic plank at that point, because there's so much other stuff you can do. And one thing I'm doing in my quest to get back to where I was before the hernia surgery is getting up on, you know, my toes up on a Swiss ball, hands on the floor. Basically, I'm in push-up position with my toes up on the Swiss ball, lift one leg and try to hold it up there. And I'm almost to the point where I could hold one leg up for 30 seconds and then put it down and hold the other one for 30 seconds and go like 60 seconds continuously without falling down and, you know, having a bloody nose and running for the running for the locker room. So I'm almost to the point where I could do this for 60 seconds, but that's what a Swiss ball is great for. You know, it's great for just one variation to push yourself a little bit farther than where you went the last time. Work on that variation 3-4 workouts, then move on to something else. Same with the TRX. I know there's this idea that, you know, you have the TRX, so now you have to design all these workouts around the TRX. Well, you know, you could, but it's better to use it as one tool with, you know, one tool of several within a workout.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to jump in and mention, last time we had you on, I did mention that the Testosterone Advantage Plan was the first ever fitness book I ever purchased after Core Performance, because I picked up Core Performance more of as a Nomar promoted it on like ESPN. So I got it because Nomar told me to. But
he personally told you to pick it up, huh?
He said, "Kevin Larrabee, go to your mom, ask her." I was like, I think I was 16 at the time Core Performance came out. Yeah, it must be because it's
what, 6 years ago.
Yeah, no, I was like 47
years ago.
Old.
Yeah. So anyways, I got to ask you, I mean, today we have all this, you know, all these different kinds of fitness out there with, you know, there's definitely the CrossFit crowd. You know, we still have the bodybuilding crowd that's out there, and we have the functional crowd and things like that. You know, over this last, let's just say like the last decade from Testosterone Advantage Plan, or maybe even the Book of Muscle to where we've come today with the New Rules of Lifting for Abs, you know, what have you kind of seen as like the trends that stayed true? Because so many things seem to have changed in just a decade from what we've been recommending to people.
Well, I'll say this before I answer your question. It's incredibly difficult for somebody who, they go to a bookstore, they go on Amazon, and they see Testosterone Advantage, and maybe a friend of theirs has told them about it, and they buy it, and then they come to you with these questions, and I have to explain to them and say, look, that book, we started writing that book in July of 2000. You know, it's 10 and a half years. If somebody's emailing me now, that was 10 and a half years ago when we started writing that book. We were in a corporate situation that was in flux, and there was a lot of, there were times when we didn't know it was going to come out, if it was going to come out. There were times I was personally ordered to find somebody else, to find an MD and pretend that he wrote it, so that my byline wouldn't even be on it. I would have to pretend that somebody else wrote the book because they thought it would be more authoritative if it came from a doctor. So we had a lot of that was a very challenging book, because I think for all of us who were working on it, it was our first fitness book. So that book was, I don't want to say that there was anything about the program that was necessarily compromised, because it was Mike McNeil's workout, and that's the way he would have designed a workout in 2000. 2010, no way he would design a workout with leg presses and leg extensions and some of those exercises. Diet was Jeff Volek, who's mainly known as a low-carb guy, but back then he didn't think that the science really supported low-carb across the board, so it was a Mediterranean-type balanced macronutrient diet. So I think everybody who worked on that book would do the exact same book in a very different way today. You know, if we were given that title, or just, you know, given the order to, you know, this same group work together, come up with a book, I think we'd come up with a very different book than what we did back then. Same with Home Workout Bible. In fact, Rodale, my good friend Adam Campbell, came out with a terrific book called the Men's Health Big Book of Exercises. You guys have seen that, right?
I own it.
Lee, you're a part of that,
I'm
right?
I'm in the women's.
Yes.
Right. So there's a Women's Health Big Book of Exercises also. Yeah, I remember Lee contributed to that. Alan Cosgrove contributed to the men's version of the book. I think Rachel Cosgrove contributed to the women's book. So that was like, as Adam told me, that was, you know, it was a combination of an update of it was really a combined update of Home Workout Bible and Book of Muscle. And Adam apologized to me. You know, it's like, well, I'm sorry, we're going to cut into your income here.
It's funny that you're coming out with an updated version. Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because when it came out, it made me think of the Home Workout Bible. That's what it made me think of when I read it. So it's funny.
Yeah, and you know, that was a very successful book. Hard to do. I think the hard work shows in that it's very, you know, there's a lot there. Again, today we would have come up with different exercises. We certainly would have included more. We would have had, you know, a lot of things, types of exercises we don't have now. A lot more. Let's see. That book came out in 2002, I believe. So I remember we started working on it almost as soon as we were done with Testosterone Advantage Plan. And again, that was just a time of the company was changing so fast. Different people were in charge almost every other week. So, you know, that one I don't think was as big a political football as Testosterone Advantage, because I think everybody got that. There was nothing controversial about it. We weren't telling people to eat more fat or eat more protein or not do as much cardio. So I think it was we had sort of passed that barrier. And plus, of course, it helped that, you know, that the company had made about $1 billion off of South Beach diet. So all of a sudden they weren't scared of lower carb diets anymore, you know, because they realized that they're very profitable. So all that pressure we faced for Testosterone Advantage Plan, for telling people that, you know, the carbs might make you fat, were you know, that dissipated when all of a sudden there was that much money on the table. So Home Workout Bible, not controversial. Book of Muscle, it was, but for different reasons. And so we get to now, if you don't have all that political interference and people are a lot more comfortable with the material, and plus, you know, you've got like another 6-7 years of exercise science and practice, more qualified trainers now doing more things with more clients, you just learn more. So that, you know, I don't think there's any dogma that guides the evolution of this. I literally think that it's based on what works best. I mean, certainly Alan is, he's got a staff at his gym. He's lecturing around the world, certainly around the country. So he's constantly exposed to new ideas. He's constantly trying new things. And so this is, when one of our books comes out, this is what the state of the art is right now as we understand it.
I think that's interesting that you mentioned that, because, of course, that's true. I mean, and you see that all the time, even in academic books, second editions, third editions. Now, and I'm thinking, Kevin will appreciate this because of all the reboots that Hollywood is doing. Have you ever considered rebooting any of these books?
I have not. I mean, I feel that, well, can I just talking about the New Rules franchise, that book had a couple of fits and starts. It was, I think the original working title was Basic Training. It was going to be a book for beginners. I was never really comfortable with that because I don't think anybody considers themselves a beginner. Everybody thinks they know how to lift weights. So when we called it New Rules of Lifting, what our real goal was, let's take all the complexity, which is normally what books are. They're, you know, that's why you get somebody to buy a book, is you show them something really complex that they couldn't figure out on their own. So that's why they need your book. So with this, we said, let's strip this down. How basic can we make this? Like, out of hundreds of exercises, they're all really based on a handful of moves, right? So let's figure out what those moves are. That was the New Rules of Lifting. Of course, we had more than a year's worth of workouts because that was the complex part, which is, now we're going to show you how to progress this. We're going to show you periodization. We're going to show you different ways of arranging these exercises, different ways of, you know, periodizing these workouts. And when we were done with that book, I don't think that any of us thought that we were going to go any farther with, that there was going to be another book called New Rules, because, I mean, what are they going to be, the newer rules, the new rules? This time we're really serious. These are really new. And a lot of people pointed out, you know, and a lot of the people who, you know, were perhaps, you know, didn't care for the book, or maybe they liked the book, but they, you know, certainly a lot of helpful reviews on Amazon.com point out, well, these aren't really new rules. This is stuff that if you know weightlifting, you already know. And, of course, that was gets back to the original idea of the book, which is that most of the people working out don't know this stuff. They've overcomplicated it, or they've oversimplified it, and they don't know they don't know these rules. So when we went to do a women's book, and we got the idea for the women's book, like the week that the men's book came out, I started hearing from women saying, "Well, why did you do a book for men?" So I don't know, because I used to work for Men's Fitness, and I worked for Men's Health, and the excerpt for this book is in Men's Journal. I don't know, where do women fit in there? And women said, "But you know, can we do these workouts?" I said, "Of course you can do those workouts. I just didn't think anybody wanted to. I didn't think there was any appreciable number of women who would want to work out like this." So almost immediately, I discovered otherwise, that there was tremendous interest in this book. Even in the media, I was hearing more from female journalists. I was on more radio shows hosted by women than I was hosted by men. And so I realized, well, there's a lot more. We really blew it here by not making this a book for both genders. So then the next book was, the working title was Lift Like a Man, Look Like a Goddess. And that became the subtitle of the book, because after we had finished the book, the sales staff at Penguin, our publisher, said, why don't you just make it New Rules for Women? I mean, because you've already got a New Rules book, so people will get that now this is the New Rules book for women, right? I mean, didn't women tell you they want a New Rules book for women? Why'd you give it a different title? So, you know, it's like at that point, I don't want to say light bulbs went off. It was more like just, you know, you hit yourself in the head and say, yeah, all right, so sorry. We're not as smart as we thought we were. We should have figured that out. So that's the second book. Again, no idea, you know, no real plan that there was ever going to be a third book. And when the third book did come along, I've already explained the genesis of that. My first thought was, well, this should be like the New Rules of Core Training. Realized we can't use the core training title, so that's when it became the New Rules of Lifting for Abs. And I think the rest of the series, I hope continues, will progress like that. When we have a different need and a different way of approaching things, you know, it'll be the New Rules of Lifting for Something.
Cool. John.
Yes, sir.
I think, Lou, do you have like 5 more minutes? Do we have you till 6?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just, like, if I open up the door, I'm going to have to deal with my kids and stuff. So I'd much rather talk to you guys.
Exactly. Well,
one of the things I want to ask you about is, obviously, I mean, you have a passion for writing, passion for editing.
Hey, I'm sorry. Nobody has a passion for editing.
Well, I guess, yeah.
Editing is what you do if you want to get paid.
Yeah, that's true.
Writing is the fun part.
So, okay, if money...
I'm glad you gave me a chance to clear that up. Thanks.
Yeah, just let everyone know. If you weren't writing about fitness, what do you think you'd be writing about?
I don't know, because the first part of my career, I was coming out of journalism school in the late 70s. I was one of those, you know, I was the feature writer, and, you know, newspapers used to have this big staff of people. You know, you'd have like the living, they call it the living section or the feature section, or the today's, you know, whatever they decided to call it, daily magazine. They would have the staff, and there'd be like one person would be the food writer and one person would be the advice columnist. And then there'd be two or three people who were, you know, the feature writers, and they're the ones that go around and they cover like eating contests and, you know, and you go and you cover the wacky stuff. So that's what, coming out of journalism school, that's what I did. Interviewed celebrities, went into, you know, never that part of my career. I could usually find work if I needed it, tried to run away from it a few times and go do other stuff. But it was something that I was just basically one of those journalists who was a feature writer. And in the late 80s, as this idea that the gym culture was not just a fad, that it was kind of here to stay, you know, that there were these health clubs that you know, they may, one may close, but there another one always open. So it was something that people by the late 80s had kind of figured out was here to stay. And because I was the only one on, and believe me, the only one on staff who worked out at a daily newspaper, I would be the guy that if they wanted to do something like, you know, how to not, you know, get totally out of shape over the holidays, well, they'd send me out to do that story. If they wanted to do, you know, talk about, you know, what's new in gyms, they'd send me out to do that story. Injury rehab, sports training, that sort of stuff. I'd always get those stories. Still had never occurred to me that this was going to be something that people would actually get paid to do full time. I've told this story a bunch of times. I ended up, the newspaper I was working for in the late 80s went out of business. I moved back to California, was at graduate school for creative writing at the University of Southern California, answered a blind ad in the Los Angeles Times looking for an editor. And it turned out to be Men's Fitness Magazine, which at that time I'd never heard of before. And I didn't get that job, but I did get hired part-time at Muscle & Fitness, another Weider magazine. And then eventually, a few months later, they created a new position at Men's Fitness and brought me in for that. So that's how I ended up being a full-time health and fitness journalist. So if that whole part of my career hadn't happened, I probably would have ended up specializing in something else, because I don't think there's many journalists who just do general stuff anymore. What it is, who knows? You know, I might have been the guy who writes about electronics. I mean, you know, if there was a full-time, I mean, like, I wouldn't have been the guy who writes about cars, because I wouldn't even know how to begin to operate some of these things. You know, I drive like, you know, a Toyota Camry, and I always joke that, you know, I have like a silver Toyota Camry that, you know, I always joke that, you know, this is a limited edition Camry because it was one of only 10 million silver Camrys made that month. So,
pretty much.
You know, that's where I am on technology, especially automotive technology. But who knows? It would have been anything. I would have been writing about something, though, because the alternative is actual work, and man, that's difficult.
No one needs that.
I could have sworn it was going to be sports.
You know, I was a sports writer for like 15 minutes and sometime in the early 80s, and I got fired. And I was not. I always thought, you know, like if you're a sports fan, you could write about sports, right? It just looks easy. And man, the first time I did an interview with a monosyllabic high school basketball player, I'd been assigned to go out and write about this guy who was like this big rising star, and he had like the worst game probably of his life. And so I'm in the locker room, and I'm trying to interview this guy, and I've got to come, you know, and he's giving me like, you know, these are his answers. And so I've got to write a feature about this guy, and somewhere I, you know, mentioned in there that he had this pretty bad night. Story appears in print, and man, I was just, you know, the coach was irate, the fans were irate. Oh, dare you, you know, this guy's a great player, and you go and see him one time, and he's having a dinner. Yeah, but, I mean, the newspaper, they just sent me out to see him one time. You know, that's what did I do wrong? And, you know, I finally figured out, boy, I really am not cut out to be a sports writer. And I figured that out about 30 seconds before I got fired.
Isn't it nice when you can look back on something and be like, I got fired, when at the time you're like, oh, my God, what am I going to do?
Well, I don't know that. I don't know that it ever really gets easier. I mean, it's I just like, you know, I like to be honest with myself and admit when something was completely my fault. And in that case, I was in a job that I thought this was going to be the coolest job in the world. I was, you know, in my early 20s, and I've been hired by a daily newspaper to cover high school sports. And I thought I played high school sports. You know, I wasn't any good at it, but I think I basically understood what was going on. And I sort of got through football season because I had played high school football, got into the winter sports, realized I had no idea. I had no idea how basketball worked. You know, I would hear coaches. I didn't even know that. I just thought there was like a center and two forwards and two guards. You know, so people are saying, oh, you know, so are two guards, you know, doing this? I'm like, So I realized I don't actually know anything about sports. Always thought I did, and got my comeuppance. And, you know, newspaper made a mistake hiring me. And I made a mistake thinking that I'd be good at that. But I'll tell you what, you know, it's like everything, and I've tried and failed like more things that I could counter anybody would want to know. But each time, it gives me a little bit of perspective on how difficult these jobs are that look easy from the outside. And I'll tell you, writing about fitness, the reason that I've been so successful at it was because when I started, nobody else wanted to do it. I would go to that's how I got the job at Men's Health. The person who was, I think, the last two or three people who had covered fitness, they all really wanted to get out of it and do other stuff. One of them ended up being a best-selling novelist who's, like, one of her novels was reviewed on the front page of the New York Times section, weekly book review. And, you know, what was she doing writing about fitness? Well, it was what they hired her to do, and she got, you know, worked her way out of the beat as fast as she could. The person before her who did it was Greg Gutfeld, who has his own talk show on Fox News now. So, you know, guy who wants to be a talk show host, you know, doesn't want to be writing about sets and reps. I was the only one who was willing to do it and who was willing to take it seriously and use it as a career path. And the biggest mistake I ever made was making it look like it might be fun. So now there's like all these other people who want to do it, and I hear from people all, oh, you know, how do I get to do what you want to do? So you don't, because there's only like five jobs and they're all taken, you know. Most of them are people either I trained or the people I trained those people. So, yeah, there aren't any jobs out there. They're all taken. You know, people like what they're doing. You know, at the time it was really novel to be a journalist who went out and got a CSCS. Now I think it's almost like a job requirement at the magazines. It's that, you know, you want this job, okay, we're hiring you because you're a good journalist and you're qualified for it, but you got to get your CSCS. So I mean, even that is not even novel anymore. So that's my rise, and my eventual fall is that you know, there's so many people out there who can do what I do now. Eventually they'll push me off and I'll have to go do something else. I hope it's in like 30 years. You know, and I was be ready to retire anyway, but you know, you never know.
Luckily for all those up and comers, they can always start a blog, and that seems to be how everyone's getting their start now. And I think it's just, you know, for some of them, I mean, at least it allows them to get their content out there. And thanks to the Facebooks and the Twitters and stuff, people can, you know, let everyone know that they are writing stuff, and it seems to be working. I'm hearing about people, you know, every other month that are coming out with great blog content. I think we did talk about on the podcast in the past about blogs with you, Lou. And I thought, yeah. Didn't you have some pretty strong opinions on that?
I may have. From time to time, I have strong opinions on just about everything. I mean, you know, ask me about what Lee's wearing right now, and, you know, I'll give
Lee,
you back.
What are you wearing? Tell us, and, like, you know.
It's really hot, and I want you to know I'm wearing Pluto slippers.
Wow. Right. All right, we're going to have to end this podcast.
Yep. Can you take it?
Censored.
Yep.
We'll bleep that out. All right, well.
I didn't expect it to go there, but that's all right.
See?
So
I have a slipper fetish.
A slipper? Wow.
Jesus.
Okay. Did not know that. Well, good day. Yeah, good thing we're not live in the studio. That might be really distracting. So I don't remember what opinion I had about blogs. I know that I wrote one for like 4 years, and every day was you know, updating it, and I loved it when I was doing it. And then at a certain point, I realized that I was repeating myself, that I kept linking back to, like, from a year or two ago. Like I said 2 years ago, and I said, you know, after 4 years, I have literally said every single thing that I could possibly say in a fitness blog, because all the news stories were just repeating themselves. It was all just, you know, diets work, diets don't work, diets work, diets don't work. You know, you should work out. True. No, you shouldn't work out. Oh, you should work out. Oh, no. There was nothing. It was just this endless repeating loop. And after 4 years of doing this almost every day, you know, all my creative energy into it, I realized Cobb's completely burned out. I had nothing left to say. If other people find stuff to say, that's great. I enjoy reading it, but you know, I was done. I recommend that everybody do it at some point, but I think there's also a point when you, if you're a professional, if you're a professional writer, I think at a certain point you have to say, there's only so much, there's only so much you can get out of giving away content for free, because. And this may sound like a sore loser thing because I never like built a huge audience on my blog, and other people who came along after me built much bigger audiences. But it was, you know, you really at a certain point I realized I've really got to focus on stuff that's more, you know, that's of more lasting value than blog posts, which is not anything wrong with anybody who wants to blog. I certainly did for 4 years, but when I was done, I was really done.
Cool. Fair enough. Well, I want to thank you so much, Lou, for coming back on the show. It's always, like I said, it's a huge pleasure to get you on. And for people out there that, I talked about it quickly on Facebook and on Twitter that, I got my copy in the mail and everyone's like, oh, going to pick it up. Oh, wait, it's not coming out until December 30th. So you guys, you can head to Amazon right now and you can pre-order the hardcover. It's like $16. So again, you know, it's in terms of cups of coffee, it's probably about 4 cups of coffee, depending on where you – actually, those are probably pretty expensive cups of coffee, maybe 5 cups of coffee. But
Starbucks.
Yeah, Starbucks.
Yeah, and let me say this. If you go to Amazon now and pre-order the book – If you order like within 24 hours of hearing this podcast, the price will be exactly the same as it'll be like 6 months from now. But I will feel really good if you go buy it now.
Yeah, come on, you're gonna buy it anyways. So I mean, the thing you don't want to miss out on is the first run with the hardcover, and then not get the hardcover when the softcover comes out, because I'm still happy. I still have my hardcover copy of New Rules of Lifting, and I will never ever get rid of it.
Plus, you know what? Let's keep it real, too. The e-cred is worth it.
Yeah.
Just to get the book right away and then read it all in one night and then write your own blog review of it, the e-cred.
Oh, yeah.
It's like
huge.
Very meta. Yeah.
And I'll tell you what. Anybody out there who goes out, anybody who's listening to this, goes out, buys the book, decides that they want to write about it on their blog, shoot me an email, ask me any question. We'll call it an interview, give you any amount of material you want. I'll be able to spend a whole lot of time with anybody, but I'll be happy to, anybody who wants to write about on their blog, I will be happy to answer any questions they have and consider it a personal favor.
Very cool.
Pretty generous.
I like it. All right, Lou, we will let you go. But again, thank you so much for coming on the show. And we'll probably talk to you in about a year. I think that's standard.
Okay, I'll try to have some interesting injuries and possibly another surgery by then, so that, you know, we can start it off with some gore.
Awesome. Well, let's pencil in episode 250.
250.
And we'll kind of
not 249.5 when we don't have our crap together and can't actually. Make it 250, but actually episode 250.
Yeah, 250. That would be the good one.
It's got to be 250. Yeah, the ones where the 249.5. That's where you sort of, you know, that's like your training session where you're getting your game face on, and right. Then 250. That's where you call the Luminator and we talk.
Actually, you know what though? This, correct me if I'm wrong, but is this the first interview that all three of us have done together for one guest?
Yeah.
Think so.
Lose a big deal.
I think so. Lose a big deal.
And you know what else it is? You know what else it is? This is really special.
Yeah.
Have you heard me use a swear word in 60 minutes?
No.
Oh.
No, not a single one.
Wow. That's weird.
Yeah. And I actually on my Facebook feed, I said, you know, what's the over-under on when I drop the first F-bomb? And people say, oh, you know, it's going to be like 30 seconds. No, it's going to be like 20 seconds. No, it's going to be like the first thing out of his mouth. 60 minutes, not a single one.
That's crazy. This is like an episode of interviews, and you're the interview that didn't curse.
Makes no sense whatsoever.
Oh.
Yeah. I like to think that there's still a few surprises that I can pull out, and that was the surprise for this episode.
Awesome.
That's amazing.
See, isn't that special? Now, I don't know what I'm going to do for episode 250. I may have to do it all in like haiku, or maybe just I'll do like every sentence will be
It could be.
I'll try
it
to work in a
song.
Different swear word every sentence, maybe.
It could all be in song, like that episode
musical.
Of Buffy.
Yeah, we could do a musical.
Like you have to have a musical Buffy. Episode. Yeah.
You know what? I sing worse than I write about high school sports, so I think that'd be a really bad idea.
Why do I know that? Why do I know that the episode title of the Buffy show musical was Once More with Feeling?
Because it was one of the most brilliant pieces of material.
It really was. I can't believe I know that.
Okay, guys.
All right.
I think we're good.
We're devolving.
Okay. All right, Lou. Well, we will we'll let you go. And like I said, we'll talk to you in about a year. And everyone make sure to pick up the new book, The New Rules of Lifting for Abs. It's going to be on bookshelves around December 30th. And you can pre-order it on Amazon.com right now. And, also another good thing about Amazon, you have a pre-order price guarantee. So if they do drop the price before it gets sent out to you, you'll get the lower price. So you basically, I just gave you so many reasons to go to Amazon.com and order it. So go do it. How did I do, Lou? Was that pretty good?
That was terrific. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Lou. We'll talk to you later.
Okay,
great talking,
take care,
Lou.
All right, see you in a year.
See you.
Bye.
Bye. With me right now is Alan Aragon. Hopefully you've checked out his site at alanaragon.com, or if you're like me, you've picked up his book, Girth Control, and also you can check him out at alanaragonblog.com. And we've mentioned many times in the past, in the last couple of years, the research review that he offers there as well. Alan, it's great to have you back on the show.
It's a pleasure being here. Thanks for inviting me, Kevin.
Well, we talked to last maybe a year, a little bit longer than a year ago. First thing I want to kind of ask you is, what have you been up to? You have started a blog and you've been blogging up a storm. And if people haven't been checking it out, you've been posting some great stuff on there. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
I'm glad you think that. My goal is to do at least one blog post per month. Whereas other bloggers have a little bit loftier goals than that, I would imagine. It's kind of a way to reach out and get a little bit social, come out of my cave, and of course promote my stuff. I've had a lot of fun with it. Let's see. Probably the most significant development since you and I last talked was a reduction on my end in the number of days I go to the office. So when we last talked, I was probably driving to work 3 days a week, and now I've cut it down to just every Monday where I see clients in person. And then the rest of the time, I am sitting my butt at the computer or, chasing around my kids or harassing my wife. So, it's kind of an evolution in the right direction, I think.
Very cool. And if you don't mind me asking, when you do go in on that Monday, do you generally, train all those clients and then they train on their own for the rest of the week?
It's really common for folks to think that I'm a trainer, but they highly overestimate my work ethic. I mainly sit on my rear end and just tell people what to eat and counsel them in that direction. Yeah. Yeah, my office is actually based in it's a personal training studio, but it's huge. It's called Elite Fitness Plus, and it's the size of a very big health club. So it would be sort of misrepresenting to say, my office is in a personal training studio. It's a big space with a full staff of trainers, and I let those guys take care of the training end, and I just counsel people on the nutrition end. That's a little bit different. I do have a small online clientele that I maintain, and they keep me in line. They keep me humble. but yeah, for the most part, when I show up to work physically, I'm sitting on my butt and just flapping my jaws.
Awesome. Well, it still sounds like plenty of fun.
Yeah. I enjoy it.
We were talking about your blog a little bit. One of the questions that one of the great things about having you on the podcast is I generally have a lot of questions for you. And one of the ones is about your blog. And I have to ask you about the blog that you had on credentials in the fitness industry. You make some great points basically stating that you don't need a degree or even a certification to become, you know, become respected and very successful. So I have two questions. What do you think of this? What do you think is the secret sauce that makes guys like Bill Phillips so popular within the general public? And do you think all recommendations should be made only on research or in combination with anecdotal evidence? Or what, man, I should have wrote these questions better. And I'm caffeinated right now. I'm sorry. or what on some forums might call, quote, real life evidence. I know this is a loaded question, but I would love to hear your opinion on this.
Okay. Well, I'll take this bit by bit. I think that probably the thing with Bill Phillips is a combination of the fact that he's an interesting character and he appears to really care about people. So I think that's kind of the combination. I mean, the fact that he put together Body for Life and he sort of reached out to people's emotions, I think that's going to capture a bigger audience than appealing to people's intellect, because with the latter side of things, you have a wide range of education levels and innate levels of intelligence and understanding and stuff, and so you just have a huger market if you appeal to emotion, and that's what Bill Phillips has really nailed down really well. And of course, selling EAS for millions and millions and gazillions of bucks doesn't hurt either when you try to go off onto other projects, you know. let's see. So that's what I feel is the, you know, kind of the secret with Bill. And, okay, recommendations based on research versus real world stuff or research versus anecdotal evidence. I think that it depends on the topic. Like, for example, if we're talking about physiological processes or these little micro processes that can only be investigated and sort of picked apart in controlled experimental conditions, like, for example, you know, hey, what level of this or that substrate in the blood is required to cause this effect, or what's the dose response curve of this level in the blood according to you know or how does it affect this endpoint that we're trying to reach? You know, these little micro aspects that people debate over on the boards having to do with, you know, things like insulin, etc. That sort of thing, you really got to go over to PubMed, and you have to find out how the primary researchers have dissected these type of questions. And other questions like, okay, what is the best way to help somebody adhere to a program? Or what's the best way to help somebody stick to a diet? And other questions like that that deal with a little bit more macro aspects and practical type of aspects, well, then the introduction of anecdote and personal field experience becomes a lot more valuable because there's certain things that haven't necessarily been thoroughly fettered out in the research. So I'd say it really kind of depends. The little bitty tiny physiological processes, studies are important. Some of the bigger stuff that are a little bit less concrete, a little more qualitative, then personal experience is a bit more valuable. But it helps to kind of consider the whole range of the stuff while keeping in mind that anecdote is subject to a lot more validity threats than research evidence, whose main threat really is just the common methodological flaws as well as funding bias. So, yeah, that's my mouthful on that.
Yeah, and one of the best parts about the research review, if you don't mind me blowing some smoke, is that you
go away.
Yeah, I will. Is that you always do mention when it is noted who funded the research that you are reviewing, which I think is one of the most interesting parts about reading it is these companies investing thousands of dollars to do research just to try to that tends to always be a little bit biased to back up the supplements that they're selling. One thing that I would like to kind of ask off that is, have you done any research on the psychological aspect of the marketing that a lot of these supplement companies do to make their product so appealing, even though, you know, they could literally have people that buy their stuff get practically no results, but then see an ad for it and then still buy their product?
You know, I haven't actually done any formal digging on that end, but I do look at the ads, in especially in the magazines. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at the Muscle Tech ads, and they grab the newest rising star, like some guy in his early 20s who just won the Nationals or something to that effect, and then they do a fake quote that he says, this product, I rely on this product to give me the strength and the cuts and the size that I need, type of stuff. And then, you know, you put yourself in the shoes of the kids who are looking at these ads, and it's mind-boggling to think that a good portion of the people are looking at the ads and thinking, wow, if I take this product, I have a chance at looking like this guy. When obviously, to you and me, there's no way in hell they're going to look like that guy without the proper genetics, proper drug regimen, and obviously the proper work ethic. So, yeah, it is mind-boggling, and I don't know if there's any real definitive answers on how that stuff gets through and how it affects folks, but yeah, funding bias, commercial bias is an interesting thing. I was just having a discussion about this on bodybuilding.com with somebody. You know, it's interesting when every month when the research review crunch hits, I kind of go into I turn into Mr. Hyde from Dr. Jekyll, and then all the freaking bro science pops out at me, and I just sort of attack it like an angry person. And I presented a bit of research in a debate, and then the guy who I was debating just dismissed the research completely, saying, who's the funding source? Who's that funded by X, Y, or Z, or whatever? And the counterpoint I made was, you can't completely dismiss research based on the sponsor, because, you know, in some cases, the sponsor is actually onto something. Like, you take creatine, for example, and you look at the early studies on creatine. I mean, most of them, if not all of them, they're industry funded. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it sort of comes out in the wash. Different independent labs test the stuff out, and then, you know, non-vested entities test the stuff out, and then it turns out, well, you know, hey, well, creatine works. But fact of the matter is, it did start out with severe industry funding bias for a long time. So, you know, it's not, although funding bias is something to factor in and kind of, you know, pepper into your judgment, it's not something that's strong enough to completely dismiss a study. So, yeah.
Well, and it's very interesting that you bring up creatine, because when something that might have been declared as the next creatine, it also seems to be funded pretty heavily by the supplement companies. But again, you kind of think it's because they think that they're onto something, and by, mm-hmm. you know, just making sure they can back it up with some research can make it an even better product or promote it even more.
Yes, that's right.
Cool.
That's right.
All right, so we got this next question from a couple different people. I'm going to try to – well, we got two questions that kind of revolved into the same question. But basically, what is your stance on intermittent fasting now, and would you recommend it to anyone?
I used to have a kind of a negative view of intermittent fasting a number of years ago. But as research has come down the pike – It really isn't this muscle catabolizing, hypoglycemic pass out type of regimen that it would easily be kind of presumed to be. So intermittent fasting is fine. It's one of the options available to people. In my opinion, it's a better option for people who are trying to lose weight than it is for people who are trying to gain weight. And it's actually a pretty elegant option for people trying to lose weight because of its simplicity. So I personally don't see anything wrong with intermittent fasting. And again, I mean, all of this has to be tempered by individual response. You know, anything can look wonderful on paper, but until you try it and see what your level of tolerance is to it, then you know, you're really not going to know. So intermittent fasting is fine. I see it as a pretty strong option for weight loss.
If people are interested in it, there seems to be a bunch of different resources out there. There are people that are offering information on this. Is there anyone in particular whose information that you like a little bit more?
Oh, well, you know, for sure my homie from Sweden, you know. Martin Birkin and his leangains.com website. I mean, he's done probably the most research on the topic of intermittent fasting, and he definitely has all of the knowledge on why it theoretically may have advantages, and he's done his homework with that. So, and not only that, I mean, he's probably one of the guys out there who takes research very seriously and sort of uses that as a standard, and he's one of the guys who's aware about the difference between anecdotal evidence and research evidence, and he knows when to kind of draw the line and actually say, okay, well, this has not been demonstrated in the literature, but this is a hypothesis that I've got that's based on this, you know, these bits of circumstantial evidence, etc. So I would definitely go with Martin Birkin as far as the intermittent fasting approach goes.
So same question in terms of the PSMF diets, the protein-sparing modified fat diets. What are your feelings on those? And, you know, again, is that just kind of a fad diet, or is it something that can be very effective for fat loss?
Okay, well, the protein-sparing modified fast in its original incarnation was a sort of a therapeutic type of starvation situation. And it wasn't constructed optimally because it didn't have all of the – it wasn't fortified with essential nutrients. And you know, it didn't necessarily have enough protein. It certainly didn't have enough essential fatty acids. Some incarnations of it supplemented the subjects with essential vitamins and minerals, but you know, that's not quite enough. You still need enough protein, and you still need enough essential fats. Mm-hmm. So if somebody does a protein sparing modified fast, then they would definitely want to not follow the original incarnation of it and go with something more along the lines of what Lyle McDonald has put together with that. Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, he's got this book called Rapid Fat Loss Handbook, and it takes the older protein sparing modified fast concept and sort of beefs it up into something more sound as far as the essential needs of the dieter. And in the end, it's an 800-ish calorie diet. So you know, the people who that diet is appropriate for really boil down to either folks who need to crash diet for whatever reason they've got. It's a reunion, or it's an appearance, you know, it's a public appearance or a TV appearance, and they, you know, they haven't been doing their homework, they've been pigging out and whatnot. You know, it's for sort of extreme situations. Another population who it might benefit are the extremely obese, or you know, the morbidly obese. Since a good amount of the research shows that quicker fat loss at the beginning is correlated with greater long-term weight loss maintenance. So, and the reason why I think that is more a function of people being more motivated by the fast results at the beginning, and rather than some sort of function of the physiology itself of rapid fat loss. So if somebody's losing 10 pounds a month, they're going to be more likely to stick with it than it's somebody who's just losing, you know, 2 or 3 pounds a month. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the reality of it. And yeah, so for certain populations, it might have greater utility to do a crash dieting type of thing at the outset to kind of kickstart things psychologically.
The next question that we have comes from Brian. He says, my question is for Alan about post-workout nutrition. I've heard some people say that if you're looking to lose fat, that you shouldn't eat anything immediately after a workout because it blunts growth hormone. Is there any truth to this, or is it still better to eat right away to enhance recovery?
Okay, a couple of things here. It depends on the goal. So if somebody – you take – Let's take a goal where none of this matters, okay? You take somebody who's 30, 50 pounds overweight. All they give a damn about is just getting out a fat bill, okay? None of this nutrient timing shit matters at all, really. I mean, just get into a calorie deficit and maintain it any which way but loose. Make sure you're eating enough protein to maintain lean body mass. And then those are the essentials, and you know, other things like make sure that your training program isn't ridiculous and imbalanced and lame and things like that. But nutritionally speaking, there are populations for whom nutrient timing is the last thing they need to give a crap about. So now, if somebody's thinking about growth hormone and its relation to nutrient timing, I'm going to assume that this is somebody who is perhaps trying to build muscle. Well, in the case of somebody whose primary goal it is to build muscle, worrying about blunting growth hormone is kind of hilarious because in the beginning, transient fluctuations in growth hormone really don't mean jack diddly after you're past a, you know, infant stages of life. Once you're an adult, it really doesn't matter. And secondly, what a lot of people don't realize is that growth hormone elevation is a compensatory response to stress or insufficient fuel. So you can actually elevate growth hormone by depriving your body what it needs. You can elevate growth hormone by either starving or, you know, even sleep deprivation will cause transient increases in growth hormone. So it's mainly a compensatory response. What you really want to give a crap about is for this particular person who appears to want to build muscle, you want to be able to increase muscle protein synthesis, net muscle protein synthesis, by giving your body enough of what it needs and more by the end of the day. There's a lot of debate about how much the how closely do we need to worry about nutrient timing within the day? But as research marches on, for populations other than endurance athletes with multiple glycogen depleting workouts in a day, for populations other than that, it almost doesn't matter a whole lot beyond getting the targeted amount of protein and carbs and fat by the end of the day. So, that's sort of my huge run-on sentence for that. I mean, this is kind of a big question, but there are benefits for there have been benefits demonstrated with training in a fed state versus training in a fasted state. And there have in the research there is data showing that delaying the post-workout meal can raise markers of muscle protein breakdown, etc. But usually those cases have been in the absence of a pre-workout meal of any sort. So You know, there's huge gaps in the research with respect to nutrient timing, but in the huge picture, it makes so little difference compared to nailing your macronutrients by the end of the day. If this guy who asked this question, if he gets a caloric surplus in and he nails his protein, carbs, and fats by the end of the day, he quite literally doesn't have to worry about the nitpicking timing stuff.
Mm-hmm. Cool. We got
Doesn't that suck? Doesn't that suck? That's so unsexy.
Yeah, I know. Come on, sell me something. I want to increase something by 500%.
Yeah.
We got a great follow-up to that from Dan, who says, it's a great question. Which of the – and I should – for people that don't check out your blog, you have tended to look at some of the, quote, bro science terms and theories on your blog, and also supplements that are – pretty good sellers out there and kind of mm-hmm. tore them apart. You've done it in the research review as well, mm-hmm. just to give people a little bit of reference for Dan's question, who obviously reads some of your stuff. He says, which of the, quote, bro science myths do you disagree with most, and are there any that are actually have some legitimacy, like higher meal frequency, higher GI carbs post-workout, maximum protein intake per meal, carbs before bed, etc.?
Okay. The carbs before bed thing is a good one because I was just having a debate about that pretty recently. People try, and this is usually the bodybuilding crowd. The bodybuilding population has this underlying thought that the more I'm suffering and the more of a pain in the ass my diet is, the better I will look. And, you know, that's just purely and simply not true, but a lot of people are motivated by suffering. So if somebody of that mentality hears that, okay, you cannot have that freaking potato with your steak at night. Other, you know, it's getting in the way. That potato that you're having for your final meal of the day is getting in the way of your progress, and so you need to cut it out. Or better yet, you need to move it towards an earlier point in the day. Then it's easier for folks who are motivated by suffering and have this automatic idea that suffering equals results. They'll just automatically latch onto that, and they'll defend that idea with anything they've got, even if it's not scientific. So that's one of the things, the whole carb cutoffs thing. All it is a calorie cutting for dummies tactic. That's all it is. You know, if you I give the example, you know, somebody will lose fat if you only let them eat from Monday to Thursday. You know, that's it, man. The next time you can eat after Thursday is Monday.
When's that
You'll
book
probably
coming out?
Lose weight. the Monday to Thursday diet. Oh, 2 weeks.
Just get me on the pre-release list, okay?
I will. Yeah. Give me 2 more weeks. So yeah, that's one of the things that really bugs me. And incidentally, the whole no carbs at night thing has actually been looked at in the research. And unfortunately, there's only one study that I know of that's looked at this, where the participants had either 70-ish% of their calories at the early part of the day versus 70% of their calories in the evening. And this diet was the typical stupid research diet, which is like low protein, high carb, moderate fat. And, you know, probably unsurprisingly to folks like you and me, there were no differences in the amount of fat loss that happened as a result of either having most of your intake at right before bed or most of your intake in the morning. It's the same shit. You know, your body is not on some odd awareness of what's going of what time it is, you know. So, and the interesting thing about that study was that the participants were actually on an exercise program that occurred during the day. So you would assume that the people who were eating most of their calories during the day and you know, exercising during that vicinity would have better results, but but they didn't. And obviously there's gaps in that study, and there's ways that the study could have been done better to suit our population. But, you know, it's one of the bits of evidence that you can refer to about this particular topic of carbs at night. And then you have the anecdotal stories of the carbs at night thing. I mean, the only time I ever dieted specifically for the purpose of losing body weight, period. All I did was freaking skip my breakfast and lunch for a string of weeks. lost a lot of weight. You know, lost a lot of fat. Lost inches in the waist and the whole nine yards. It's really not much more complicated than your caloric balance that you sustain. Timing of nutrients and stuff like that, it's all sexy and it's all cool, it's all high tech, but so far there's not enough evidence behind it to really be adamant about the claims related to that. Let's see, okay, other myths and stuff. Glycemic index is another way for obsessive compulsive fitness enthusiasts, and we all are OCD in some sort of way, so I'm not knocking everybody and not pointing the finger at myself. Glycemic index is just one of the nth degree nitpicking things that you could possibly burden yourself with, especially if you're a dieter. The bulk of the glycemic index studies compare a low protein, high carbohydrate diet that just is ridiculous with another diet that may or may not have the protein content matched. And so obviously they're not controlling for the protein intake between the diets. And so it's not necessarily a case of, okay, the higher glycemic index diet causes more adverse effects or less weight loss, etc., than the low glycemic index diet. It's that basically getting enough protein beats the crap out of getting insufficient protein every time. So, you know, they're beginning to realize this flaw in the research, and stuff's beginning to trickle in where they attempt to match protein intakes. But then when in the construction of the high glycemic index diets, they choose just a bunch of candy for the carb sources, and they compare it with whole food sources in the low glycemic index group. And, you know, really, what the hell do you think is going to happen?
You wouldn't recommend that.
No, I wouldn't. So yeah, it's a lot of it is based on unrealistic protocols, and people freak out. They, oh, low GI this, low GI that, and there's just a lot more to it. I would recommend anybody, flat out, unless you are a diabetic who insists on eating a high carbohydrate, low protein, hypercaloric diet, then you don't have to worry for one split second about the glycemic index of foods. While I'm on the topic of myths, I'm going to throw in a little plug for my favorite diet, which is the paleo diet. And this reminds me of the concept of the burden of proof, which is really interesting. Somebody on the bodybuilding.com forums posted a thread saying, "Hey Alan, can you please point me to the research showing that the paleo diet is not the, you know, the big deal or the savior of humanity that some people make it out to be? Because I know that you, Alan, have taken many pot shots at the paleo diet, and I want to see where you're coming from with that." And my response was, well, you know, the burden of proof is not on me to provide evidence that the paleo diet is something magically special. The burden of proof or the scientific onus is on the goofy guys making the claims that the paleo diet, it will impart special health effects beyond a diet matched in optimized macronutrient amounts. You know,
did you get in on any of that stuff that was on, was it Tim Ferriss's blog?
No, in fact, I just freaking looked up who the hell Tim Ferriss is earlier today. I just Wikipedia'd him. Who the hell is this guy?
Everybody's talking to him lately.
Well, he was brought up on the body recomposition forums, and somebody linked the trailer to his new to his book, the 4-Hour Body. And man, that's a hell of a trailer. Wow, you know, they even used Seven Dust for the theme music. I'm a Seven Dust fan, so I almost like I almost became a fan of Tim Ferriss right there because he chose Seven Dust. You know what I mean? But yeah, no, I honestly, I had no idea who the guy was. But if he's jumping on the paleo bandwagon, well, then it's not surprising because it's kind of it's an alluring concept, you know?
It's Let's got all the answers. There's lots of answers in the book.
Oh, yeah, lots of answers. I mean, I thought of just dropping everything I'm doing right now and just getting the book and telling everybody to F off. You know what I mean? So, it's if he's jumped on the paleo bandwagon, I'm not surprised. It's sort of a very alluring, very catchy, almost romantic. It has this sort of magnetism to it that, you know, we get back to nature, we cut out these evil Neolithic foods, and then we become great. Well, you know, the burden of proof is on you, my friend, to demonstrate that a diet with matched macronutrients is imparts measurably greater health effects than another diet that happens to contain some non-paleo approved foods. You know, burden of proof is on the paleos to justify and substantiate their religious beliefs there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the most interesting aspect of the whole paleo diet is, like you mentioned, it's like a religion. And there's kind of like almost a cult following, which my response has always been, you know, all right, if it works for you, then that's awesome. If that's what if that's the diet that you like to follow, that's great. But, you know, it's not going to cure cancer. You know, it's not going to, I just, like you said, when I read that whole blog post and the like 1,000 comments that seemed to, expel from the people that were fighting back and forth. One of the people that was on it was our, you know, Lee Peel from the podcast, and you know, very interesting discussions. And it was just, it seemed like a lot of the discussion that came back from the author. And I actually do have a copy of the book. I've looked through it.
The 4-Hour Body?
No, the Paleolithic.
Oh, the Paleolithic diet. Okay, gotcha.
You know, the author's response to a lot of her stuff was, well, you know, well, I saw it in this person. You can't tell me I didn't see it in this person. I saw the results in with this client. I changed her diet, and my mind has gone a blank when the specific disease or issue that was going on. But it's just very interesting. It's another part of, like, I seem to get more and more interested in the psychological aspect of this whole, you know, everyone's just mindset when it comes to training and nutrition and how they get interested in certain things in terms of, you know, what necessarily drives someone to go to, whether it's like a T-Nation or go to a, you know, like a body pump form, or people that really are into like CrossFit. I just find it really, I mean, they're complete, like, again, you know, it's different strokes for different folks. I'm not going to say that you're wrong. But I'm just going to say it really is something that, you know, interests me when I hear all these stories, because we're very lucky to have a diverse audience. That we have lots of CrossFitters that listen to the podcast, and they will defend it. And they make sure to email me when we talk about CrossFit. We did, a couple of weeks ago, I bashed on CrossFit quite a bit.
Is that when you found out you had a lot of CrossFit, audience members?
Yes. That's when the emails came in, and, nice. We got about, I want to say about 35 emails from, CrossFitters, just to me personally. They're nothing that was directed towards the podcast, but, you know,
I'm surprised they could actually type in the, the complaints with all the calluses from those kipping pull-ups, you know?
Well, I mean, to be honest, that was one of my main things, is just we got this whole discussion, Lee, John, and I, about the safety and the rationale behind a lot of what they do, and, especially when it comes to the CrossFit facilities and how they're not really governed, to be CrossFit certified doesn't really mean a lot. You can still do lots of stupid shit. Just like if you're a personal trainer and you're certified, I don't care what certification you get, like ACSM or NASM, whatever, you can still do stupid shit. So I think it's a very interesting topic, and I think CrossFit's very interesting. Paleolithic diet stuff's very interesting. People that are just so passionate. It's like, I don't want to get political, but it's like the teabaggers, you know? I mean, if you...
Oh, he did not say the teabaggers.
No, the that's what they're called, right?
I thought you were talking about D-Mag.
Oh, no. I'm talking about, like, the people that, you know, threw tea into the ocean to protest the Democrats and stuff like that. But
man, I thought you were just bold second, Kevin, you know?
All right, well, you know what? I still got plenty of friends over at the good old Tea Nation. So,
what draws people to T-Mag is I've always thought it was the figure athlete pages, you know, powerful images. I mean,
they got some great pictures.
You know, I mean, it's like, I mean, you know, I ever since I've been banned from the T-Mag forums, I just go there to look at the powerful images.
Oh, they didn't block your IP or anything like that?
No. I can still look at the powerful images.
I hope they have an... go ahead.
The paleo thing and CrossFit, I mean, they kind of... It sort of intersects. Because, like you said, there's definitely a passion of belief behind both modes of operation. You know, with the whole paleo lifestyle, it's almost like it strikes an emotional chord with folks to kind of deviate from the march of technology and the bad stuff that it's done, et cetera. Whatever you might want to add there about the march of technology and what it's done to the human condition. So what I've done when people ask about paleo, I tell them, well, you know, why don't you be consistent in your attempts at regressing? Why don't you sell your car and take showers in rivers? You know, why not just go all the way with the paleo thing? You know what I mean? It's really hilarious. I mean, there are healthful aspects of the paleo diet. Anytime that you increase the proportion of whole foods and minimally processed foods in the diet, you're by default going to increase your chances of taking in more nutrient dense, calorie sparse foods. However, when you start discriminating against various whole foods like potatoes or peanuts or whatever because it's not paleo, that's when things get really wacky, and that's when you have to step back and say, look, man, You're turning a good thing into a ridiculous fad diet that has no foundation and that has no concrete foundation to begin with. We're speculating and we're assuming, and there's a lot to the paleo diet in terms of criticism and stuff, and I've done a lot of that in my research review. It's an interesting topic, and I think that because it strikes an emotional chord. It's sort of the same thing with CrossFit. CrossFit is sort of the way I see it, is kind of a rebellion against the pink dumbbell, universal machine gym culture that has its own negatives, you know. But then they kind of swing the pendulum the other way around, where you get people doing a bunch of funny movements to utter exhaustion and bleeding all over the damn place and thinking it's cool. So, yeah, I mean, there's extremes. Yeah, it's badass. Yes. Yes. But CrossFit, what's the motto again? CrossFit, it makes, you have to help me out on this.
Come on, man. I don't do CrossFit. I don't know.
I know that there's a whole legion of people who know the motto. So I'm not even going to try
not doing it right.
No, it makes women hot and it makes men something or other. I'm freaking not remembering the thing, but I remember being funny at the time. So,
well, I can Google this. I don't know if I'll okay. find it or not. But.
Okay. Yeah, let me know when you find it. But then, you know, it's very similar to the bodybuilding culture where, you know, their motto is why go halfway with anything when you can overdo it? So it's very similar to that. So we're not, you know, directing singular hate along the lulls fitters.
You know, that's actually an interesting correlation. I searched for CrossFit motto in Google, and then CrossFit Toronto came up, which is CrossFitTO.com. And right on the side of the page is Paleo Gourmet Brands.
Yeah.
Correlation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, there a lot of CrossFit. Now I'm speaking in generalizations. There obviously Absolutely. Are exceptions to the rule. CrossFitters, they had a big hard on for the zone diet at one point. And that kind of, well, to be frank, it was a pain in the ass to put together these little 40-30-30 blocks. Mm-hmm. And then so it paleo is a little bit simpler. Just cut out about three or four food groups and you're good to go. And not only that, you're more hardcore. You're more caveman-like. So, well, you know, it matches up. Boy, Kevin, I feel sorry for you, man. You're going to get a lot of hate mail.
I know, but I also made sure to mention alanaragon.com. There's a little section there where you can send some. just to even it out. Even out, just CC. Just CC Alan to all this stuff. And
well, you know, there's good and bad about every program.
You mentioned that it's all generalizations. This is, again, people that do CrossFit, you're not necessarily doing something that's wrong. If you do it right and you're safe about it, it's not necessarily a bad thing. We're talking about the people that go all the way over to one extreme and they do stupid shit.
Yes, that's yes. And a lot of the times, CrossFit is a good introductory type of gateway for people who are unfamiliar with pushing themselves physically and mentally, or you know, just being consistent with a rigorous program. You know, it introduces people to that, and a lot of times they sort of graduate from that and use a little bit more sound, methodical type of approaches, and they incorporate that, and they kind of evolve away from the sort of stereotypical CrossFit thing. So, in that sense, it can be a good introduction to pushing yourself. It reminds me of the P90X program. You know, it's easy to make fun of that hilarious set of DVDs where that dude just annoys the holy dickens out of you the whole time. But fact of the matter is, it's introducing soccer moms and soccer dads and stuff to actually pushing themselves and moving some weight and getting off their asses and it introduces them to progression as well. So good and bad about this stuff, even though it's easy to make fun of.
Absolutely. Well, cool. Actually, you know what? I think that's a good place to wrap it up. I don't think we can cause any more trouble than we just did. so I think it...
Yeah, I'm sure we could.
Well, let's try it. I want to keep some listeners on the podcast.
Okay. You guys, CrossFitters, love you. P90X, love you. Paleo, oh my God, love you the most. How's that?
Yeah, if you could post a link to the Paleo book and promote it, maybe a good review.
Lauren Cordain, I have a shrine of Lauren Cordain with Rob Wolf sitting, baby Rob Wolf sitting on his right hand. Love it.
Rob Wolf, we have had some requests to get him on the podcast, so I don't know if that's going to happen.
I had a debate with Rob Wolf in 2007. So ever since then, he and I have somewhat steered clear of logging horns and whatnot. I mean, he seems to be a smart enough guy. I don't know him well enough to spout off opinions and things like that. But yeah, the whole paleo thing is definitely more of a religious bent than a scientific bent. Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
I think that's what makes it so interesting, though. It is very much like a religion, just like CrossFit. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you know, the people that I think that's really, in some cases, it's very good. If you find a community that you feel very comfortable with and it allows you to reach whatever goals you want to get to, you know, cool. No, all for you. It's could be worse. You could be sitting outside of McDonald's, just like with a bag of quarter pounders.
Right. Right.
Actually, that doesn't sound that bad.
Especially right around now.
I know. It's getting towards... Well, for you, I mean, you're very lucky. At least if you ever did go do the fast food route, you have the In-N-Out
burger. In-N-Out, right? In-N-Out.
I got to go to once when I was in California, but we don't have those out here.
See, that's why I'm staying here in the West Coast, because there's no In-N-Outs on the East Coast. That's a shame. That's a damn shame. I have In-N-Out every week, man. Every week, gotta have some In-N-Out.
Do you say stuff like animal style?
No, my go-to In-N-Out order is a triple single, which is three meat, one cheese, no sauce, so you can taste the meat, and grilled onions, extra tomatoes. So that's my go-to In-N-Out order, and of course you got to have it with fries and a shake. That's the formula there, brother.
We gotta see if we can get those out there. We just got a Sonic in my area, and that was a big deal. So maybe the In-N-Out guys will eventually start making their way towards the East Coast, or maybe I will just have to move back to the West Coast and
hang out. Probably the better move. You know, before I sign off, I want to give a shout out to Adam Bornstein. Do you know who Adam Bornstein is, Kevin?
Oh yeah, we hung out when he was up here he did a men's health feature for a bunch of facilities.
Yes, Adam Bornstein. I told him I would mention his name twice in this podcast. Fitness editor for men's health, just an all around great guy. He is responsible for how good my sex life is. And I know it's hard to. You know, make that leap and figure out what the correlation is. But you know how it is when the whole thing about women and getting turned on. There's this one comedian who's not too far from the truth. Female Viagra is money.
That's true.
So every time I forward an assignment, conversation with Adam to my wife, dude, it's freaking fireworks, man. So I want to thank you for that, Adam Bornstein. Stud, men's health.
Didn't know if there was some, feature that we should be looking out for in this month's men's health and the sex section or whatever it is.
I know. Who needs this nutrition stuff, right? And that's about it. I want to also mention that the research review is my main project and something that just, it's ongoing every month. And to find out more about it, just either go to alanaragon.com and click the research review link on the top menu, or go to alanaragonblog.com and click any one of the banners that are just, blasting on that site. And, that's about it with the self-promotion.
And you still haven't missed a month yet.
not yet. Sometimes I lag, but it's always worth it. Always worth it, for sure.
Well, I think we will wrap it up on that note, and I will say we'll do it one more time. Adam Bornstein, you also said that you were going to be coming on the podcast, so email me, and we'll make that happen.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you for my sex life.
Yep. Okay, so... Again, Alan, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and helping us celebrate episode 200. Really appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you, Kevin. And gosh, I was going to throw another shout out, but I better bite my tongue.
I'll do it. Come on.
Okay. I want to thank everybody I debated with on bodybuilding.com the last couple of days for the ad hominems and for some of you, the actual reasonable comments. It keeps my workday fun, and it gets me through the research review. It gets me all fired up, so I want to thank you guys. That's it. I'm hoping that that Lee Peel decides to come to the JP Fitness Summit 2011.
Called out.
Ah, she just got called out. You just got called out, girl. And that's it. That's it. Thanks, Captain Fred. We'll
honestly, I mean, for people that have been reading, I guess we are kind of jumping into the interview now, but as I've been reading your blog and stuff over the last couple of weeks, you have been traveling quite a bit. What has that experience been like?
Well, do you want to start the interview?
Yeah, might as well. I mean, we're kind of keeping it casual as usual, but we might as well.
Oh, sure. Well, it's been great. I mean, I'm off to San Diego twice in the next 2 weeks, and I mean, it's just funny because people call me up and say, "Can you do a workshop?" I was like, "What's September like for you? You know, what's October like for you? What's, you know?" Because it is really getting built. I mean, and the thing is, I mean, the more workshops I give, the more I seem to find, you know, that people ask a question. It's like, oh, well, I can help you with, you know, and all of a sudden, here we go again. I'm off on a new direction, you know, which is kind of fun.
Awesome. Well, I another thing that we did kind of get a couple questions about is in regards to nutrition, because I know you're kind of going through, or at least in one of the videos that you posted, which, I mean, if people haven't been checking out danjohn.net, Dan's been posting videos pretty regularly on his blog, and one of the things that you mentioned in one of the videos is that you're kind of going back after traveling so much to, you know, kind of the you know, protein shake diet with one solid meal and, you know, lots of fish oil. I guess my question would be, A, you seem to have found that to be very effective, but, you know, definitely from what I've seen with, you know, my clients and athletes, it's definitely a different strokes for different folks kind of thing, where some people might not be able to follow such a strict regimen. But I mean, I personally saw you at a hotel in Los Angeles at a bar where everyone was having buffalo wings, and like, I would love to have a buffalo wing, but you know what? I think the quote was, "Those buffalo wings look so damn sexy right now." I think that was pretty accurate. But you know, how's that going for you? And you know, just talking about overall, you know, what your feelings are about the diet that you're doing.
Oh right, yeah, right now I'm just trying to undo when I went on this last trip. I mean, it was for a wedding in Philadelphia, and then Thanksgiving, my daughters and my family in Utah. So basically, it was just about a week and a half of drinking and partying and having a great time. And you know, the funny thing is, you know, I did train. I think I trained practically every day. I think the day of the wedding, maybe I didn't because I was in the wedding. And you know how that goes. You just get caught up in tuxedos and, you know, dropping stuff off. But, you know, I got off the plane. And one of the problems with being 53 is that, you know, travel begins to affect you almost immediately. It's like, I mean, I looked the last weekend, my wife and I went to the Cal Washington game. We got sideline passes. It was awesome. It was one of the really fun dates I've been on with my wife. It was a great time. But the pictures made me look, my face looked like I put on like 7 faces. Well, I was also in a turtleneck and a, you know, and so I kind of got everything squished. But the thing is, you know, when you're about 53 years old, your responses to travel and a week of partying tend to be immediately showing your face. You know, I kind of moon face up a little bit. So the reason I go on that 3+1, it's from the EADS, EADES. They wrote Protein Power, which the original version is one of the best Protein Power lifespan program. But that book was phenomenal. The exercise program with leaping and jumping, they've sold out to something else called Slow Burn now, which is completely opposite of everything that made sense in their books. You know, the idea was that you wanted to kind of mimic the human landscape of 10,000 years ago by jumping and leaping, and you know, I thought that's not a bad idea. But now they argue that you should do, you know, 1 rep for 30 seconds or something like that. Like, well, how does that fit into the human landscape? You know, 10,000 years ago, or was it 13,000 years ago, when you know, there was that minor asteroid impact in North American ice sheet that made the Clovis people have to migrate. If they had migrated really slowly, they'd have been dinner. So, but it's from their book, I think it's Middle-Aged Fat Loss, where you do three protein shakes a day, and then you eat dinner. And it's kind of like, so it's somewhere between the warrior diet and the velocity diet. But what I like about it is, one of the things I've discovered in my life is, even though I eat a lot of protein, I seem to do really well when I eat more protein than I even think. I don't know if that's a personal thing for me, or if it's something that everyone should go in, but I tend to do better on more protein. So I do three protein shakes a day. Actually, it's probably only two, because I never seem to remember the third one. I work out in the middle of the day now, and then I eat a big dinner. And dinner is, meats, vegetables, basically, and really excellent Pinot Noir, usually, because we live in California now, and wine is cheaper than water here. So, but I don't recommend it. I wouldn't. It's a nice little short-term burst, and I'd strongly recommend that for many people. Though I'm still convinced that if you have the courage to eat vegetables, a fibrous thing like a bean that you can trust, and a protein at every meal, you're probably on the right track. So, if you could have eggs, black beans, and vegetables for breakfast, for most people, you're probably never have issues with obesity or blood sugar or anything. You're going to be fine. But when you need to jumpstart, you need to jumpstart. And so that's what I'm doing right now. And please, I'm not recommending it. I have a photo shoot for my book coming up, and I want to, kind of get my body weight down to something reasonable, So that's kind of just the real basic. Sorry if I got you lost there. Okay.
No, it's perfect. And one of the things I want to quickly just hit back on is, you mentioned you seem to be doing, or you seem to do better with more protein. Is that in terms of energy levels, or just like satiety? Like, are you just not as hungry? Or,
well, my three diet recommendations are always more.
Mm-hmm.
So more protein, more fiber, more fish oil. And when people take that advice and they jump into it, and they I have some people up to as many as 22 fish oil capsules a day, and they knocking down Metamucil at night, and taking extra protein shakes. One of the first things they start to talk about is elimination.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize, this kind of low level constipation or this low level elimination issues. And I'm no expert on this, but one of the things that you find with the fiber and the fish oil is that, all of a sudden become much more regular, which, as I understand, is great for fat loss and for heart health and for all these other issues, too. Now, the protein is just something I picked up working with Chris Shugart a couple of years ago when I was convinced I was taking enough protein. But when you really take time to look at it, I was taking a lot of protein. Like, for example, I'd eat, a lot of eggs for breakfast, and I'd have meat for dinner. But that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was finding that, especially when I was at a competitive body weight, when I was competing, heavy as a thrower, a Highland gamer, even as an Olympic lifter, you're walking around, you walk around 240, 250 all day, and it sounds like a lot of protein at six eggs and, half a pound of meat at dinner, but really isn't. And maybe, some protein, obviously, the day, here and there, but I was way under the amount I actually needed. You think you're taking it enough because, you have, charred meat at many of your meals, but it might not be enough to hold up an athlete at that body weight. So I found it in for me, maybe and this is all, and I'm not being exacting here, but for me, the additional protein shakes seemed to help me. It seemed to help me actually through the training programs. That's the one thing I usually pick up. That's one of the signs, I think, when I know I'm doing things right. Like yesterday's workout, yesterday's workout was just kind of a mishmash of things. I did a high half-hour bicycle ride. I did a whole bunch of Turkish get-ups. I did a whole bunch of kettlebell snatches. I did some pull-up work, and I did something else. I don't remember what it is, but I'm sure it was really important. What I noticed with that workout, when I'm on a higher protein diet, I can spend more time in the weight room. Now, that should be opposite. Most people say, well, if I'm a, you know, if I drink my magical carb drink, you know, before, halfway through, and after. But I came in after, I had no food in me at all. I mean, I had a protein shake probably 5 hours earlier. But if I'm on more protein, I tend to be able to train longer. Now, that's me. Maybe I'm just an experiment of one, but I've had other people tell me the same thing, is when you've got your protein dialed in, your workouts, you seem to have more in the tank for your weight workouts. Now, I don't want to speak about, you know, like a runner or something like that, but for us, it seems to help us. So really, if you think about the diet as being more and more and more, I think you're on the right track. If you think that way, by the way, too, you know, following this up, you know, if you read like Tim Ferriss's new book is coming out, and he's a big believer in the slow burn. Well, at every meal you have a protein, every meal you have a legume, every meal you have a vegetable. Well, that's the more, more, more. That's more protein. That's more fiber, right? If you look around diets that make sense to you, generally, they, for at least for me when I see them, they have more protein and they have more fiber. Then you just add the fish oil as you will. But there is a certain kind of simplicity to those three things. And the funny thing is, it seems to work for fat loss as well as muscle gain. I certainly don't want to bore you with diet stuff, but those are the kinds of things that I'm kind of really starting to realize the longer I'm in the game.
No, trust me, it's not. It's all great stuff, and from many of our listeners out there, you tend to be the favorite guest that we have on the podcast, basically because you go in depth and you don't leave any stone unturned. So I think that's a very good thing.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll talk longer then. No, okay, great.
Trophy's in the mail. I gotta get that trophy made. But yeah, from the comments and the, you know, response that we got from having you on for episode 200, which, you know, we kind of rolled right into the interview as we got started, but you know, one of the things that has made this you know, podcast so good is, you know, having you on. And way back, I mean, it feels like a, you know, not so long ago, but 4 years ago, you know, being able to film that squat video, you know, I think it was viewed over 100-something thousand times on Google Video. Which just blows me away that whenever people look for, you know, squat form, that's one of the first videos that pops up in Google. And, you know, it's just still boggles my mind. It blows me away. And it's, you know, some of the best comments that we ever get is saying, oh, you know, found you from the Dan John squat video, was able to fix my deadlifts, you know, was able to actually loosen up my hips and go ass to grass for the first time in years. And, you know, again, I hope you get some of those comments as well, and they're not just coming to me, but just watch.
Well,
isn't that
awesome? I mean, seriously, that's great, because that was like, somebody just said, will you help me with something? And I said, right, isn't this true about how it kind of happened? I said, well, let's just meet up at 7 o'clock here, and we broke into the janitor's closet, and I think we just had a chair and literally a broomstick, right?
Pretty much, yep.
That's amazing. That's amazing. That's right. And yeah, I get referenced that sometimes by people, but I don't really see a lot of comments on it because I don't have any. But I'd like to see that. That would make me feel better, a bit happier.
Absolutely. I'll forward to them, form to you from now on.
Hey, thank you. That means a lot. Thank you.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about form, because one of the questions that we got a lot was about the kettlebell swing, because kettlebells are becoming a little bit more prevalent, not only in, you know, strength and conditioning facilities, but also in the commercial setting. One of the big controversies, I guess you could say, it was kind of blown up quite a bit, but a couple months back, Jillian Michaels had her own kettlebell. She did her own demonstration of how to do a kettlebell swing and basically butchered it. So I love some of the comments that you made in your DVD series about the kettlebell swing, but, you know, just what are some suggestions or some recommendations or tips that people can put into use to clean up their form on the kettlebell swing, or at least make sure that they're performing it, you know, the way they should be?
Sure. And you know, you're right. I mean, when you look at that, I mean, I only saw a few bits of it. I was shocked at how bad her technique is. Now, I understand the LA Times went after it too, but it's a good warning. It's a good warning for people. You know, I took my kettlebell down yesterday to work out. You know, I moved from Utah to California. So now I have this little gym in my apartment complex, this beautiful apartment complex. And this woman looks up and says, oh, I have a kettlebell. My personal trainer showed me that. And I asked, you know, who it was. And, you know, is the person certified? I don't think so, you know. And so you got this person, and it's like, and I got no problem with it. I mean, because it's a, you know, this is just the way it is. But I can guarantee the person teaching this lady the kettlebell swing isn't Pavel, isn't Dan John, isn't Brett Jones, isn't Mark Chang. You know, somebody who just kind of went to Walmart, bought the $10 one, right, and now is an expert. Okay, a couple things real quick. When we talk about squatting and we talk about swinging, the uninformed will think we're saying the same thing, and it's not true. The squat movement is maximal knee bend and maximal hip bend. That's kind of rule one. The swing is maximal hip bend, yes, and minimal knee bend. So right there, you have this line. In fact, if you want, you can write this down on a piece of paper, and you put them on two sides of a piece of paper, and you can start a continuum here. What the swing is that probably the most powerful thing a human can do. It is what you want to do when you do a vertical jump. It's what you want to do when you do a standing long jump. If you're running down a path and there's a rattlesnake in front of you, what most people want to do with the kettlebell is what you do with the, if you saw that rattlesnake. They want to bend their hips maximally. They want to bend their knees maximally and get their face as close as they can to the rattlesnake's face and then jump over it. The correct thing is to put your butt back, snap your hips. So if you can remember that image, what would I do if there's a rattlesnake at my feet? That's what you want to do with a swing. So it's butt back, snap, butt back, snap, butt back, snap. It is minimal knee bend. When I teach the Romanian deadlift, okay, for example, I stick you against, in fact, that's in that video, I think. Am I right? Don't I teach the Romanian deadlift where everyone put their butt against the wall?
Oh, yep.
Yeah, okay. Well, that is what a swing is. A swing is, it's funny when people ask me, why don't I teach Romanian deadlifts anymore? I do. I do in a gym setting. I do when I have it for 4 years. We do a lot of it. But if I teach you the swing, and you master or you get pretty, you know, get a quality swing, we don't really need to show you the Romanian deadlift because you're doing reps of 20 of them now. You follow?
Gotcha.
And so what happens with the swing is that if I was going to put a list of issues with the swing, issue number one is that most people do a squatting swing. And you can see it really well in Miss Michaels' video. In fact, I would say she doesn't have, God bless her, because it's important that she does it so wrong. Because it's so quick, like the one she has where she puts her head down and throws her head. That is wonderful because that is like what happened in a car accident, too. And I'm not being a jerk. I'm just saying it's important because it's obvious that she's a celebrity now. And so she can come in, see something, and think she's an expert. But, you know, someone like myself, I can't do that. I have to go to classes. I have to learn. I have to talk to people. You know, I'm going to have no street credibility at all. You know, outside of a very narrow little window, no one knows who the hell I am. So I have to know what I'm talking about, okay? So when she teaches it, she teaches a heavy leg. You'll see how much the knees bend when she teaches. There should be minimal knee bending. Now, when there's minimal knee bending, you should really start to feel that in hamstrings. Like the Romanian deadlift done correctly, the next day your hamstrings kill you, which is why the Romanian deadlift is such a good exercise for football players, is it really mimics the game much better than the traditional deadlift styles, okay? So when you're swinging, you know, you want to be this be the first point, just this basic point. Your hips are going to bend as much as you physically can. Your knees are barely going to bend. The other point I tell people is that most people let the bell get way out of control. The target in the swing, you should try to hit the kettlebell on your genitals. Now, if that doesn't cause you to snap your hips out of the way, maybe not on the first rep, but I guarantee after that they'll do it right. And what most people do is they let that bell get way out there, and I'm talking about in front.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to attack the zipper with the kettlebell. And what will happen is you'll get this nice, tight, tight swing. And in fact, it'll feel kind of odd at first because it's such a, it's so snappishy. It's snap, 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 snap. And that's what you want. You don't want this massive range of motion with it. In the same way, if you're in a basketball game and you have a massive range of motion when you go up for a rebound and you sweep your arms way back, then you sweep your arms way forward. By the time you get in the air, the game will be on the other side of the court, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be a quick snap. It's got to be a quick snap, 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 snap. So I don't know how well I can explain it, you know, on a telephone interview, but that's about as good as I can do so far. So two things, maximal hip bend, minimal knee, and attack the zipper with that bell. And then on the hike, you know, that. Anybody who knows anything knows that you've projected forward. Don't go vertical at all. Brett Jones sometimes will describe it as you put a chair in front. Okay, so I'm doing swings. He puts a chair in front of me, and the idea is I'm trying to project the bell onto the chair. If you want to put a kettlebell overhead, you do snatches. And I'm actually getting more and more to the point that the kettlebell snatch, and maybe I shouldn't even say this, but of the six key movements in the kettlebell world, I would tell most people not to kettlebell snatch. It can be done well, or it could be done brutally. Sadly, 99% of the time I see people snatch brutally, and that 1% is kind of nice. But, you know, if I'm working with 100 people, my theory is always this. If I'm working with a bunch of athletes in, I don't know, what, 80% of them don't get it within 10 minutes. Even no matter how great it is, you got to throw the exercise out.
Mm-hmm.
And the kettlebell snatch, just, it takes a lot of focus. It takes, the learning curve is there. I mean, I'm not throwing it out. I'm just saying for most people, that most people just want the quick fix. They want to learn it now and then move on. Then maybe that's not for you. But for me, with the kettlebell, so what I have most people do now, is a kettlebell swing with the weight only getting, belly button height or so. And then I teach the kettlebell clean and the kettlebell clean and press next. And so I use the kettlebell clean as an aerobic work, whatever you want to call it, cardio or whatever you want to call that, as a gut buster more than anybody. One of my favorite little workouts is 8 kettlebell cleans, left hand, 3 kettlebell single front squats, switch hands, 8 right cleans, 3 front squats, switch hands, 5 cleans, 2 front squats, switch hands, 5 cleans right, 2 front squats, and then 3-1, 3-1. And it doesn't sound like much, but if you use a serious weight, which you can because it's a clean, it will gas you so fast you won't believe it. It will be a hard 1 or 2 minute workout. It will really. But the nice thing is your biceps will, you know, explode after that. So it's a nice workout. So for me, the swing, snap it, only go to about belly button height, attack it back at your zipper, snap, attack your zipper, snap, attack it, and then, you know, do that for 10 or 20 reps. And do that and just try to build a volume up on those 10 or 20 reps. I'm not a big fan of doing high rep swings only because, I mean, you know, like a set of 50 or 100, because if you start to have bad reps, I'd rather you do set of 20 and do 1,000 clean reps than one set of 100 and, you know, slowly wear something away with a bad technique.
Mm-hmm.
That was a long explanation, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, if people didn't get enough out of that, we talked about it in the past, but you have a Utah workshop DVD set where people can get at DaveDraper.com, and anytime I can, I like to tell people about it because it's, I gotta say, it must be like 8 or 10 hours long, and it was a 2-day seminar, right?
Yeah, 2 days. Yeah, it is. And the thing that's nice is that Laurie Draper, she did such a good job editing it that it's nice because, you got the philosophy one, you've got the specifics on the movements, which is nice. So there is kind of, even though sometimes things kind of overlap, she cleans it up well enough that it looks, you can see my clothes change on topics every so often because it's the next day. But yeah, she did a great job. And and it's funny is that it's like everything I do, I hate to pat myself too hard on the back, but people say, it came out 2 years ago, came out a year ago, and it's better now than it was when it came out. You know, product hasn't changed. You've changed. You picked up, I try to have things that are pretty timeless, say things that are very faddish. I don't mind fads. I love them. But, anything, when I do a product, I always try to make it kind of timeless, And I think a lot of the stuff I talk about in those DVDs is going to hold up 20 or 30 years. And that's kind of the goal, And of course, I can't imagine too much changing from the swing, but things will change a little bit and be taught better. But she did a great job, and it was a 2-day seminar, a lot of fun. I mean, one thing I liked, you'll notice that the people there, I'm in the middle of the age range there. We've got people in their mid-60s there. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of people in their late 40s, and that's really something I think that I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're 18 and a D1 athlete, or 30 and, you're a young millionaire. It does help to because everyone's going to end up getting a little bit older no matter what you try to do. And so if I can teach someone 65 to do a swing correctly and they get body composition changes from that, imagine what that can do for an 18-year-old to swing correctly. So that's why I thought it ended up actually being a good audience to work with. When I work with elite, either fighters or special forces or football athletes, some of those guys do things just better than you and I. The very first time they do it, they're just better. And that's often not a good thing to see. Sometimes it does help to see someone's got a jacked up shoulder trying to learn how to swing and learning how to swing with a jacked up shoulder,
Very cool. And again, people haven't checked it out yet. The 4-DVD set, it's only $110. So it's, cheaper than even getting into a seminar. So trust me, if you work with athletes or you want to learn how to use kettlebells yourself, there's tons of stuff in there. I mean, you go through warm ups, you go through, barbell complexes. It's lots and lots of content. If you haven't checked it out already, pretty much have no excuse. Head over to DaveDraper.com.
Thanks for reminding me because I get these email questions all the time about something I write, and I put all that stuff in those DVDs.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And so I get these questions, and it's like I know I try to give away a lot of free information. It's part of what I want to do. I mean, I answer tons of emails. Wouldn't it be nice though if someone would also buy the product and see the people doing the warm up so I wouldn't have to explain it in an email? You try to explain, some of the bizarre shoulder warm up things in an email sometimes. you try to type that up, okay? Yeah. Thanks for reminding me. I should insist people buy my DVD before they ask a question. That's good.
It's just working on your writing skills. It's just helping you get a little bit better every single time. You got to be a little bit more articulate. But again, you know what? Stop emailing Dan and go buy the DVDs. We got a really good question, and this actually revolves around one of the questions that I was going to ask you anyways, because, now working at Mike Boyle's, we coach large groups. And one of the questions that we did get was basically, you know, how do you go about organizing your workouts for large groups of athletes and making the best use of their time and the equipment? Also, how do you give each athlete the attention that they need and make sure that they all have good form and are performing the exercises correctly? And this is, again, this is from Callum. He says, I've trained people one-on-one but have no experience coaching large groups, and it might be something I'll be doing in the future. It's tough for me to get my head around the most effective way to do this. So like, what suggestions do you have? Or I guess kind of there's a couple questions inside that question.
No. You know, I don't know how much time we have, but first off, large groups are an organism. If you're used to working as a personal trainer one-on-one, working with a large group is a one. You are still working one-on-one. The one just has to be now 92 or 65 athletes. You've got to remember that. One thing that will shock most people, in fact, that's probably the saddest thing about me leaving, retiring a couple months ago, is I used to work with interns. I used to get 2 and 3 and 4 interns a year to work with me from all over the world, Germany and Ireland, of course, and all kinds of places. People would show up and work with me for months, weeks at a time. And the thing that always amazed them was how simple it is to work with large groups. And at first, they were like freaked out. But once they kind of got involved with it, it made more sense. The upside of working with large groups is this. If you have 100 people in a room and 99 people are doing one thing and crazy Eddie over there is doing something else, Eddie is wrong. He'll look around and quickly figure out what to do. There were days where, I teach the clean and press, the snatch, the clean and jerk, and I would have all the barbells out at once and everything. And so we've got a group of 65 sophomores all snatching at the same time. Well, I had 64 coaches helping you, because if you were doing the wrong thing, all you needed to do is look around and go, oh, my hands are too narrow, or, oh, I'm in the wrong place, or, oh, I'm an idiot. And so one of the things that most people miss is that they think if you're going to work with a big group, individual attention, you have to be very quick and specific, and that every athlete, everybody in your place has to be ready to get corrected once, and then you move on. If you have to correct somebody 2 or 3 times, it's wonderful. Actually, in sport, it's even better. You just cut their ass. You just, move on. But, okay, so that's rule one. Rule two is, how do you organize workouts? Whenever I come to a place and they have on the board, do 5 sets of 2 in the squat, do 3 sets of 4 in the bench, I always know the person's going to have a failure. And that you come in there, and there's always kids in the corner doing curls or just sitting around and bullshit. Okay, sorry, didn't mean to stress twice, I swear. I didn't mean to do that. They're just BSing in the corner, okay? What you need to do with a group is train them like a group. And so one of the things I always did is, there's 2 styles of workouts. I'll give you both right now. We'll just give you the basic ones. One is called On the Minute, and that is my favorite way to work out big groups. You set up, in my old situation, in the big weight room, I had 5 squat racks, 5 bench press. We had a set of 10 hurdles. This is an example. And then we had a tumbling mat, and then we had 5 platforms, okay? So here's today's workout. We'll do 8 sets of 3 on the minute, okay? So if you start in the front squat, when the bell rings at the minute, you will do a set of front squats, your buddy will do a set of front squats, and then the third partner will do a set of front squats. You'll then add a little bit of weight. When the bell goes off, I do a set of front squats. 2 does a set of front squats. 3 does a set of front squats. We add weight. The bell goes off on the minute every minute for 8 minutes. Okay? At the end of that 8 minutes, I give them about a minute to switch to the next exercise. It's bench press. On the first set, I do a set of 3 in the bench press. Add weight. Second set, do a set of 3 in the bench press. Add weight. You fall out as it's going right. Then, after that, we go to the hurdle walkover. There's 10 of them. Every minute on the minute, we walk over the hurdles. Okay? Really, in that, what you have actually is 15 people at once walking over the hurdles. So really, the train never even stops. So you can do 8 times 10 hurdle walkovers. Then the tumbling rack. On the minute, every minute, you have to do a cartwheel on the right, a cartwheel on the left, a shoulder roll on the right, a shoulder roll on the left. Every minute on the minute, you have to do that. So that gives you 32 tumbling movements. And then finally, the last exercise on the platforms on the minute is power curls, which is power cleans with a curl grip. Every minute on the minute, you do a set of 3, you add weight, your buddies do, okay? It doesn't matter where you start. So group A starts on the front squat. Group B starts on the bench press. Group C starts on the hurdle walkovers. Group D starts on the tumbling mat. Group E starts on the power curls. If you have more stations, you now see sit right there with that group, A, B, C, D, and E, 3 groups, 5 stations, that's 15 athletes. You can see how easy it would be to work up to 75 athletes training at once with this system. Can you hear that?
Gotcha.
And all I do is have an injured athlete with a stopwatch ringing a bell on the minute every minute.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the time, I can walk around and correct technique. Everybody is moving the entire time. Isn't that a great workout?
Yeah, I mean, it's I think it's great that you put a lot of responsibility on the athletes themselves.
Well, it's their athletic career, not mine, baby.
Well, exactly,
Yeah, I've had my white moments of victory. I've stood on the podium. If you want to get there, there's the route, son. It's not. Go check in the ceramics class because I don't want you in here. And that's exactly what I tell people, by the way, exactly what I tell them. Now, the other workout is, you know, it's old as the hills. I mean, we did this. The best name I've heard of is called a drum line. But it's what we used to do with the universal training. It's where you could do the exact same workout with one little difference, okay? So I start off in the front squat. I do a set of 5 in the front squat. I slide over the bench press, do a set of 5. I slide over to the hurdle walkover, and I do one set. I then do my tumbling run, and then do my power curls for 5. Then I go back. Then I go back to the front squat, set of 4. You know, then I follow myself, and then I do a set of 4 at the bench press. I do the hurdle walkover. I do the tumbling run. I do a set of 4 in the power curl, and then I go 3, and then I do 2, and then I do 1. And you, the numbers on that. I think there's some great workouts. On those workouts, I generally have the weight stay the same, but you could do the one, it's called Big 5, 55, where you do 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, which is an exhausting workout. Or you can do 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But those are the two best workouts I know in group settings. Now, I have a bunch more, but when you have a group setting, your job as the coach is to figure out a way to get all the athletes all working out at once. Now, I also believe that you should, in a group, have basically the same warm up every day. And you saw that in the DVD, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you should walk with weights. You should do basically every human movement in your warm-up every day. Now, the reason I think you should do about the same warm-up every day, it comes from my theological background, I think, to be honest with you, where people like in groups to know where things are heading. You know, for my faith tradition, we have standardized prayers. So when at my funeral, my daughters aren't going to have to think very hard to follow the prayers, okay? They're going to be able to follow along with the prayers because that's the standard prayers. It makes things easy for everybody. At a wedding, when the bride walks in, we stand up, right? Right? That's what you do? Why? Because that's what you do when the bride walks in, right? I think the same thing works with groups in the weight room. And as a coach, is that when you have a big group, you can't be jazz. Jazz doesn't work in a large group setting. You can't. Now, modern offensive football is kind of jazzy, but trust me, it's based on a lot of repetitions of the basics. Okay, so when you have a large group, it really helps that you say, okay, pick up your kettlebell, let's do waiter walk, you know, waiter walk, suitcase walk, suitcase walk, heartbeat. I have said that 10,000 times. Okay, okay, goblet squats, okay, right, you know, right knee down, okay. And because when you work with a large group, if you have, and it does happen, new people show up, people transfer in, people quit, people come back, you don't want to have to spend time teaching that new person all the new drills and all the new movements drills. They just look around and they realize that they're the only person not doing this, and they jump in and do that. My buddy Adrian remarked how amazed he was how quickly he picked up the warm-up by doing it once or twice without any instruction from me, but letting the class instruct him by their movements. And so I think when you work in a group setting, you have to have the courage to not teach and nitpick and fix everything. One of the signs that I think if somebody's not very good is when they'll walk in their living room and go, hey, look at Charlie over there, he's not squatting right. My first thought is, okay, Charlie's a freshman. Charlie's, you know, front squatting 65, 85, 95 pounds. He's only been front squatting 2 weeks. I'm going to fix him with repetitions over a four-year period. And his senior year, he's going to be stronger than anybody you ever met in your life. So you have to have the courage to kind of not jump in too much. And also, too, if you give a 14-year-old boy a one-hour seminar in the squat, they're not listening to you after 1 minute, and they're not going to remember a damn thing you said. So you have to just keep reminding yourself. And I hate to say it, but I'm sure the same is true with hockey players who are 22. You know, you're going on blah, 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 and that's exactly what they're hearing. you know, so, and I'm, now you can disagree with me, but I know I'm right, and you're wrong. So it would be a worthless discussion.
Can't argue with that. All right. Well, I think I've stolen about an hour of your time, and based on how this episode is looking, it's going to be about 3 hours long. So I think that's where we will end the interview. But
there's no more questions. There's no.
We got. I have a couple of my own questions. Actually, you know what? We'll throw this one in because this is people. I should say the audience tends to love talking about this stuff, but in terms of conditioning, you know, when it comes to the end of a training session, finishers and things like that, do you have anything that has been that you've been using lately that just kind of will kick people's asses and, you know, they'll get a great training session out of?
Well, always remember, please tell your audience, conditioning for what? You know, I mean, I everyone fell in love with the finisher idea about, you know, a decade and change ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to really kick your butt. But here's the thing that I discovered is that I was kicking my athletes' butts and myself, but it wasn't fruitful for their athletic career. So here we were having these great workouts. I was working people out, but we weren't carrying over any of the stuff. What I'm recommending to people now is that you have, you do something as simple. For example, I have to be careful because I'm almost contradicting what I said earlier, but I do 100 snatches with a kettlebell. And I do 20 left, 20 right, 15, 15, 10, 10, 5, 5. And it doesn't matter what the kettlebell size is, that's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to do it. And what I do is I use that as a monitor. If at the end of that I am so gassed I can't do anything, that's a sign to me that, you know, okay, you got to lighten up or change things. But here's the problem, you know, with the finisher, I love them, and I get it. I know why you want to do it. But be sure it carries over into what you need. You know, the book I'm writing with Paolo right now has really underscored that for my life. You don't want to finish. Okay, let's go to the athletes who don't ever need finishers. 100-meter runners never need finishers. Power lifters never need a finisher. Olympic lifters never need a finisher. Shot put, discus, hammer, never. Javelin throwers, never. Most track and field, never. Now, a wrestler might need it, okay? Now, I know everyone's a fighter now. I love that guy. Every time I go to a workshop now, everyone comes up, oh, I'm a fighter. Really? Have you ever been in a ring?
Seeing a lot of tap-out shirts?
Oh, shit. But, yeah, it's that and the word elite is driving me out of my mind. I guess somebody who's in fighting should get that. But really, I mean, I would put on a fireman's mask if I was a fighter and train those. You know those. You know, seriously. I mean, if you have to practice breathing with someone, you know, with reduced air, reduce the air. Don't work out harder. So be sure you're in a sport that demands it. You know, in like for example, when I first started coaching football, I saw the need for finishers. But with the modern game, you know, where you're running in people, except for offensive linemen and quarterbacks, you're running people in and off the field now almost after two plays. I guess some defensive backs stay out there the whole time, but they're different. But even in football now, the need for a finisher is becoming less and less. Now, you might argue, Dan, this is for mental toughness. Well, that's great, but if you run a kid off, like there's a great 30 by 30 on ESPN about Marcus Dupree, where this coach, who I have no respect for, from Oklahoma, ran the greatest running back of all time off of his team. You just ran a guy who gained 245 yards for you in a bowl game off your program. But why did you do that? So I guess what I'm telling you about finishers is to make sure they have a value before you apply them. Now, you work with hockey players, is that right?
You know, we have all types of athletes. We do have lots of hockey players, but we have all sports.
Okay, but I mean, as a hockey player, it might be worth, you know, time talking to a hockey coach or the players themselves how much they need a finisher. I'm not poo-pooing the idea. I'm just saying make sure you need it. Mm-hmm. If you're doing it for fat loss, well, I would make sure you look at your diet side before you... before you kill yourself too much, you know, because if you don't have your diet locked down, all the finishers in the world, they're just gonna blow your joints apart, and you're still gonna have a beer belly. You know? So, I wasn't trying to be mean. I'm just saying I think my job in this industry is to remind people what's the goal. You know, the goal is to keep the goal. But really, for me, the best finisher I know is Farmer Locks. We can sit here and talk about all these fancy things. pick up, for most people, 85-pound dumbbells. Go take them for a go walk. Start from your gym and walk as far as you can in 10 minutes, okay? And then I always joke, then turn around and carry them back. It took you 10 minutes to get them out there. It'll take you an hour to get them back.
Yeah, doesn't sound like a ton of fun, but it seems like we do have an audience that likes to kick the crap out of themselves sometimes, and there's one way to do it. Go out there and grab some dumbbells and just walk for 10 minutes.
Now, just for the record, I'm cheering you on all the way about beating yourself to death. However, just make sure you run it through your goal set sometimes. You know, I'm not telling you to be a pansy. I'm just saying make sure that this stuff ties into what you said you wanted, okay? It's not just a way to get more tired. Getting tired is easy. I mean, do 10,000 jumping jacks. You'll be tired, but it might not have any help to what your goals are, okay?
Finally, in relation to that, since you're allowing us to steal a little bit more of your time, Craig has, he just wanted to hear you talk a little bit about what the 100 rep challenge is and, you know, how to program that into his training if he is already doing something like a 5-3-1.
Oh, the 100 rep challenge how do you explain that? The 100 rep challenge is more of a stupid fun. It's a human trick. It should be done with a group. It's a great, you know, you find a lift that's, you know, I've done it with, let's see, 165-pound squats, man, 205-pound power clean, 185-pound cleaning press. My friend, the late Lane Cannon once did it with a 405 deadlift. You pick something. I did it once with a 255 front squat. Now, that was brilliant. You pick something that's hard, hard-ish, and you do 100 singles with it. It isn't a programming issue, but here's the upside of doing something like that. For example, with my 255 front squat, I did 100 singles with 255. A couple of weeks later, it takes a couple of days to recover from it. A couple of weeks later, I'm getting ready for an Olympic lifting meet, and as I'm warming up, I put 225 on the bar, and my mind says, why are you even struggling with this? You just did 255 for 100. And what it did for me was it leaped me out mentally. It breaks some barriers inside your brain pan about what is a warm up. You know, after doing that, it was like, and in fact, even when I was clean and jerking, it was like, until I got to 255, my mind was like, this is nothing. And that's actually very helpful sometimes. So what it is, it's just a little challenge. It's not. You can have a 20-rep challenge. It doesn't matter. But it's good to do with a friend or two. It's just something to kind of break yourself out of the doldrums. I think that one workout in five is going to be good, okay? One workout in five is going to be crappy. And three workouts are just you go in and work out. Out of 100 workouts, 20 are going to be pretty good then. Out of those 20, one or two are going to be fabulous, right? So one of the things the 100-rep challenge does is over 100 workouts, which is pretty much sneaking up to a year in training for most people, or you know maybe more or less depending on you know, what you do, why not throw in something you know every 100 workouts that really challenges you to get outside your box a little bit? And that's what the 100-rep challenge does. Not recommending it, not taking you to do it, but it is something that gets you outside of your convenient little happy box. The same thing happened to me when I did a Russian kettlebell certification just down here in San Jose a couple years ago. I thought I knew a lot about kettlebells. I thought I knew a lot about this and that. But 3 days in the sun, swinging kettlebells every 5-10 minutes, you know, it really broke me. Like you break a horse, it really broke me and made me really reconsider a lot of things I do. So that's the idea behind these things, and I hope that makes sense to you.
Absolutely, and I feel like I think we talked. I know we must have talked about the 100 reps of 255 before. I could have sworn we talked about, but Craig, in case you missed it, there you go. And I think that is where we'll wrap it up because my dog is farting really nastily right now, which is telling me I got to take him out. And a puppy, he has to go number two about 5 times a day. So good for him. And that should be exciting. So, Coach, I just want to say thank you so, so much for joining us for episode 200. It's been great to be able to talk to you so many times in the past. And for everyone out there, don't forget to check out danjohn.net. Go to davedraper.com and check out the awesome DVDs and the book Never Let Go that is over there. And, you know, like I mentioned before, danjohn.net, the blogging there quite a bit, posting up videos. And again, I can't thank you enough for spending some of your time with us and, you know, helping us get to 200 episodes.
Hey, and if you want, call me more often. I always enjoy talking to you, okay?
I love to. And again, I would like to get you on as much as we can because you are definitely a favorite of mine and a favorite of the listeners out there. So again, thank you so much, and we'll talk to you down the road very soon.
My honor. We'll talk soon, okay?
Sounds good. Take care.